KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan, and this is Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a minute. All right, right on. Hey, everybody, it's Mike, and it is KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, Mid-Missouri source for in-depth news, diverse talk, and music of the world. It's more than lots of things. Mm-hmm. It is KOPN Columbia, and it's Radio Orbit, just a few minutes after 11 p.m. on the 5th of February. Can you believe it? Time flies. And if you haven't noticed, I got some live sweet music in the studio with me tonight. Her name is Elise Brion. Say hi, Elise.
Hello, hello.
How are you?
All right.
Thank you for being here. And we have lots else going on tonight as well. So let me take a quick moment here to say thank you, first of all, to Elise for that beautiful music. We'll get back to her in a minute. And also thank you to Debbie Johnson, of course, Free Range Radio Theater. Great stuff coming to you every Monday night at 10 p.m., an hour before this program. Debbie does it up, and next week we'll have some local radio theater brought to you from Debbie. So good stuff. As always, Kelvin and Jason doing it up before that. Jazz plus blues is still frozen solid. Tech Radio, informative as always, helping us out with our gadgetry. And Jeff Wheeler, of course, starting things off every Monday on Uncommon Light, 3 p.m. until 5 p.m. every Monday. Great radio on KOPN. Your imagination station. I'm glad to be a part of it. And thanks also to everybody who participated in the program last week. Big thank you to Jonathan Zapp. Amazing. I love John Zapp. He's awesome. We talked about oracles in general, I guess, and the I Ching in particular. I actually did a collective reading of the I Ching on the air last week, which was totally cool with John, and lots of other great things from him. So Jonathan Zapp, if you're unfamiliar, check him out on the web at Zap Oracle, O-R-A-C-L-E, zaporacle.com. And you can also find him in my archives, of course, if you missed it. It's all on the web, www.mikehagan.com. And just sneak on over there to the program archives, all right? Okay, tonight, John J. Harper, the author of Transformers, Shamans of the 21st Century, a really nice book that brings together a whole number of different ideas and personalities, and tells a great story as well, John's story. He's got an amazing story, John J. Harper, and we'll hear all about it from the man himself in a bit. That's in about 45, 50 minutes or so. We'll also be bringing some great music to you. My new friend Elise Brion, sitting here in the studio with me, as I said, brought a guitar and a lovely voice. And we started things off. Hey, Elise, what was the name of that song that you just played?
I don't know, because that just came out.
Okay, it's called That Just Came Out.
I could come up with something lovely, a name to tell you.
Anyway, she's wonderful, and she'll be playing a few things for us here during this first hour. I got some other music from some friends of mine from St. Louis that I met in the last couple of weeks, a band called The Feed, and we'll hear some music from them as well during the interview with John Jay. But if you're interested in the music that you hear on the program, Elise and others, you can sneak on over to the music archives, and all this stuff is available there too. Links to their websites and downloads of songs and that sort of thing. So all that stuff on the web at MikeHagan, MikeHagan.com. All right, one more thing and an important one. It is Pledge Drive Week. And for those uninitiated, KOPN is a community radio station, a public radio station that is basically owned by the citizens of the community. And we have limited, I won't say none, because it's a little sketchy when you start to look really closely as to where all the money comes from, because we take money from the government. And one of my goals for KOPN, and I digress already, as I always do, but is to completely eliminate any federal funding from this radio station. I don't want a dime from these people, because you see, there are always strings when you take grants and accept money from federal agencies and this sort of thing. There are always strings, whether you think there are or not. There always are, and they have, they get their fingers in things if they like to. So the idea with KOPN, for me at least, is to make this station a truly independent station that is completely owned by the citizens of Mid-Missouri. And the way we do that is to eliminate all the grants, all the money that we take from the federal government, and we raise a whole boatload of dough from local people. And, I drive around town and I see all these organizations raising money. I see the university. They don't ask for 30,000 like we are, or whatever, 50,000. What, I don't even know what the hell we're asking for. 75,000 maybe it is. But they ask for $1 billion. They ask for, and you know what? They get it. Right? They get it. So somebody out there's got the dough, all right? And if you got $1 billion to give away, slip a few dollars our way, all right? Cuz KOPN doesn't need that much. We need about $300,000 or $400,000 a year. A year.
Make a number again?
About $300,000.
$300,000.
Yeah, $300,000 is about what it costs to run this station for the year.
Okay.
And Elise is here, and she can testify that, we don't have a whole lot of fancy stuff around here. The equipment is very well maintained, and we try to keep that stuff up to snuff for the broadcast, but we have old couches and old beat-up chairs, and all of the shelving and all this stuff is built by people who volunteer their time here. And, we're not wasting money. And we actually accomplish things here. I was listening to this whole, there's so many stories about money being wasted in this country. And I think about Katrina in particular, about all the money that was released and invested down in New Orleans to somehow supposedly resolve the situation down there and help the people who are in such difficulty. Well, there are billions of dollars. Guess what? Most of it is completely unaccounted for. We didn't do anything. We did virtually nothing. I mean, the theme of this whole business is you better be damn ready to take care of yourself, because no one's coming to save you, not Uncle Sam or FEMA or anybody else. But they'll tell you that they're going to save you, and they'll take a whole bunch of money from people to save you, but they won't save you, all right? KOPN doesn't ask for much, but we actually do things with the money that we raise here. In the last 6 months, we've got a brand new transmitter that's about to go online, and that was a big deal, and it's hard to do, and it takes a lot of work from people that are volunteering their time outside of the investment of the transmitter itself. You buy the transmitter, but then you got to install it, and you got to have work done at the site and up on the hill, and you got to make a deal with the people who own the tower, and la la la. There's a lot of it, And the people here are just amazing and huge-hearted people that are willing to help us and give their time, you know, to complete these tasks with very little money. Do you know that today is a momentous occasion, actually an historic day for KOPN? We are streaming the signal tonight. First,
really?
Tonight, first night ever. You know, I'm sort of a pirate, right? And I've been streaming my show since May of last year. But I've been doing it in a sneaky fashion because I have some friends in Amsterdam that are willing to lend me the bandwidth. But we're official tonight, KOPN.org on the web. You go to KOPN's website, click on the listen button, and there you go. Anywhere in the world now you can hear KOPN signal. Mm. And that was done in the last 6 months with money that we raised, on the last pledge drive, essentially. And
wow,
so
that's beautiful.
Yeah, there's great, great stuff. And the people that are on the staff here, we only have a few paid personnel. Most of the people here are volunteers. And all of the engineers who got the streaming thing up and running are engineers, and they all did it out of their own, you know, time. And anyway, I just can't tell you people out there listening how much KOPN means to me. They give me the opportunity to share my voice and my ideas and my friends and my musical influences and all this stuff with you. I couldn't do it anywhere else, you know. Do I fit in Clear Channel? Does Orbit fit in Clear Channel, you know, or Cumulus or any of these people? No, you know, I don't fit there. I hardly fit here, you know?
Yeah.
but they give me the opportunity, and tonight is your opportunity to help us out. And I don't have anybody here to answer the telephone, so I'm going to direct you to the website, kopn.org, and you can check out the new live stream. And you can also donate a little bit of your hard-earned cash to support an amazing institution. And I don't say that about many institutions. You know, if you listen to this program, you know, my general position on institutions is one of anarchy, that they must all be eliminated. I like to think of that in sort of an Edwardian nostalgic sense. Well, it was sort of cute while it lasted, but thank God that it's gone, you know. But anyway, KOPN is an institution that I really do appreciate, and I'm proud to be a part of. And I hope you guys like the fact that you can hear this program and lots of other interesting and enlightening and also entertaining programs. Great music all the time, great talk, and interesting conversation. So that's what you're getting on KOPN, and now you're getting it around the world. And for the people who don't think that we don't, you know, spend our money wisely, we do, and they're doing great stuff. And whether you donate or not, we're going to continue to do great stuff. But I'd love for all of my listeners to become a part of it. That way I don't have to see you on the street. You know, you don't have to hide your face. I say, wow, I heard you talking to Dennis McKenna the other night. I said, oh, well, yeah, did you donate to the show? Oh, no. And then you run away and hide. But you don't have to do that. You know, we can all be friends, and you can support the station just like you support other things that you use. You know, you pay for cable, you pay for electricity, you pay for, you know, your computer access, your internet access, I should say. And, you know, you pay for good radio. So, anyway, I hope you appreciate it. I'll shut up for a minute. All right, that's my cue, I guess. I'm gonna tell Elise to play another song here for us, and I'll pick up the telephone, and we'll get along with things in a minute. Okay, we got John J. Harper coming up in a few, well, a little more than a few, about 40 minutes, and good stuff in between. So here's Elise Brian, and we'll talk to Elise in a few minutes as well about what she's up to around town here, and mm-hmm. We'll let her play a song for us, though, between now and then, and I'll answer the telephone. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN, Columbia.
Yeah. This one is called Orbits of Bliss, Sacred and Simple. See, we're all elevating on the ovular hips of this cosmic trip. Sweet creator sent us on orbits of bliss, wondrously hovering in a starry blackness. So I can't be stationary as I do this. I'm a mission dancer. I send you the message through my sounds, heart, and hips.
Watch this, and you wind yourself up in your own universe slide style. Wild as hell. No furrow brow take I to my temple, back to the sacred and simple, the sacred and simple, the sacred and simple, back to the sacred and simple, the sacred and simple, the sacred and simple. Sacred and simple are the songs I sing, got joy to bring to the presence. Bless I and I'm back, so to heal ancestral cry. Yes, I'm moving along my path, a shining spiral. While I can see in your eye a lilting melody, it's no surprise you and I reconnecting in the now. Got imprintation of this elation to the wildness of one love. I give a shimmy and bow, belly dancing the grandmother's rhythms. I'm on a squat down and smell chrysanthemums. I bird my babies at home, and with my tits I nurse them tandem. Gonna bring it on back to the sacred and simple, the sacred and simple, the sacred and simple. Bring it on back to the sacred and simple, the sacred and simple. To eat from the stuff that your bones are made of. Talking about the rich black dirt rock with mineral love. Vitamins, let 'em in, and while you're at it, soaking some deep from solar energy. Yeah, El Sol, Grandfather Sun, spreading free rays for everyone. I pray for the water droplets shimmering my lips, speaking crisp. The love well off my hips, it so drips, and so I listen for earthly wisdom. It's all divine, let it shine, let's get on the inhale. And back to the sacred and simple, the sacred and simple, the sacred and simple. Back to the sacred and simple, the sacred and simple, the sacred and simple. Defy your stasis. Ever bestow grace upon a mother while you're dancing with your lover. Homo sapiens doing yoga to free the soul. Why four legs just walk as they feel that rhythm flow? Yes, I know that I don't know much at all, yet I stand tall. Back to my orbital hips, gotta sway every day, and I'm made to do this. Dance of life, so fly, even the pain's alright. Yeah, you will die, only to rise, in the way you decide, will divine. Back to the sacred and simple.
Oh, yeah. All right. I'm totally with you. Back to the sacred and the simple. Elise Breon, live in the studio here with me. It's Miraculous Radio Orbit. It's about 22 minutes after 11. Oh. Elise, is it sacred and simple? That's the name of that.
Yeah.
No, it's called Orbital Bliss.
It's kind of double titled. It's Orbital Bliss, sacred and simple.
Right on. All right, let's talk for a minute with you and tell me about yourself. The way it works here, people, I play independent music on the program every week, and you know, I come across stuff here and there. And a couple of weeks ago, Elise sent me a CD or dropped it off here in my mailbox here at the station, and I popped it in the little player and said, "Hey, all right, I like that." And anyway, that's how it works. And she's here tonight, and I don't know that much about her. And I know that she's playing at the Blue Fugue this weekend on Friday, but other than that, I don't know a lot. So what's your story, Elise?
Well, let's see. I don't know. I mean, I'm an instinctive woman. I'm a mama. I'm a doula. I'm an experiential midwife. I'm an unschooling mama who I participate in, you know, homeschooling co-ops. I'm a musician. And my mamahood is now evolving, so I can once again be a little bit more outward with my music. And that joyousness.
Children.
Yes. I have a boy, River, who's 5, and Lunea, who is almost 2.5.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're asleep.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I got a couple that are sleeping right now, too. That's why I do the show from 11 until 2. It's like I can take care of the kiddies and get them sleeping, and mama's asleep, too, and now I can sneak out and do my radio show. And
that's a good flow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Papa Bear is on the home front.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. What's tell me a little bit about your music. How long you've been playing and singing and writing and all that stuff?
Oh, Lord, that's a hard one. You know, I guess in a written, dedicated to structure kind of way with songs, for about 7 years, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, musical love being, I feel like, my whole life. And it's taken, you know, different paths, different instruments, and different time space for a musical play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the good thing about motherhood is that even though it's, like, put a pause on some of the outward plan. Someone's trying to get in the door there.
Why don't you go, do me a favor, turn it on, would you go grab it, all right? And I'll keep them occupied for a minute here. I'll tell them to go to the website at kopn.org and send us your money, all right? We need to raise a little money for the station tonight, and the best way to do it is to go to the website at kopn.org. .org. That's my friend Will. Come on in, Will.
Are you
coming
in?
Come on in. Come on. Come on. That's cool.
Sorry,
yeah, Will's always welcome. He might not be the most subtle of guests, but you know, hey, we got to be. We're raising money. We got to keep the doors closed tonight. Everyone's gonna come in here and try to steal our money or something. Actually, probably not. But here, listen to this. All right, where is it? I'm trying to find my little promo that my son did. For me, we were down here at the radio station. My oldest son is 3 years old, and he loves KOPN because I bring him down here sometimes, you know. And he knows all the sort of personalities and all that. And Morgan, who does Motherland Jam on Saturday afternoons at noon, is one of his absolute favorite characters. And Alex loves the Motherland Jam, and every so often he just insists that he has to come down and see Morgan. Well, Saturday was one of these days where he's, as soon as he woke up in the morning, which is usually early, he said, you know, can we go to the radio station today? You don't have to work today, Daddy, right? And I said, no, I don't have to work. We'll go down to the radio station. Can we see Morgan? Yeah, we can see Morgan. So we came down here at 10:30. Morgan's show starts at noon, right? And I knew Morgan wouldn't be here until 11:30, 11:45. But Alex was just intent on waiting for Morgan. So, you know, you got to keep a three-year-old busy for an hour or so. And so this is one of the ways that you do it.
You're listening to Radio A Bit on the air, KOPN, Columbia, Missouri, 89.5 FM. Fun drive. Give us some money. We need some money. Please, help us. Thank you.
All right, there's my boy, Alex, putting the word out. He's right. Please, send us some money. Help
us.
We need your help. I mean, you know, I tell you what. When your grasp of language is sort of tenuous, you sort of say things straight to the point.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And he's absolutely right, you know. We need your money. Help us, please. So thank you to my boy, Alex, for that lovely little message. And for everybody out there who's up to the challenge. Speaking of challenges, I'll probably throw in some of my money here as well. You all know that. And, you know, I got lots of stuff too, you guys. Think of who's on this program. You guys know the sort of people that I talk to. I got all their books. I got, you know, CDs from some of the musicians. I'll give it to you. Just send me an email. Make a pledge. You know, I'm not formal. I don't do things formally, all right? Just get a hold of me. I'll send you some stuff, you know? But make a pledge, support the station, and, you know, it'll be worth everybody's while.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, let's see. What do I got to do here? I'm sort of, whenever I do these pledge drive things, I'm always out of whack with the rest of the show because I don't sort of do the standard stuff, but I'll do it right now. So quickly, hello, everybody listening to us this evening on KOPN now, either over the traditional waves, or over the web. Today, Sunday, no, Monday, February 5th, KOPN is streaming now live, worldwide, on the web. How about it? And thanks to everybody that made that happen. But we could not have done it were it not for donations and support from the community and you guys. So we have a lot of great people that work here and do their thing, but it takes a little money to get things done, equipment and licensing and servers and hosts and all this stuff. But they did it, and we're streaming now live to the world. And it's all coming to you because of you. Maybe not you, but it should be because of you. If it's not because of you, make it because of you. All right? Go to the website, kopn.org, make a donation. All right? It doesn't have to be a lot. It can be a lot. I'd love to see people donate lots, you know. But whatever you can give is plenty. And we appreciate everything, every dime, you know, every penny. We recognize that you guys appreciate it. And I also recognize that there are people out there that can't give anything. And, you know, that's all right, too. If you can't, you can't. Don't feel bad about it. You know, a lot of people that can't. You're lucky you got a fucking radio. Pardon my language, you know. But if you can't give, you can't give. All right? And there's the FCC. I'm just going to get a $350,000 fine for that last one.
No, it's okay? All clear. It's all good.
Yeah. Anyway, so now we're going to need to raise some more money for the station. But I just get intense about it. And it's like, you know, people need this resource. And I hope you guys will try to help us, all right? I just had a message here from an anonymous listener that says he'll match dollar for dollar in the next hour. Wow, and it even sort of rhymes. At least can put that into a song, maybe. But it's 11:30, so between now and 12:30, my anonymous buddy here will double your money, okay? So if you send me an email, if you donate on the web, just put a little timestamp on it, all right? Make sure I know, and I'll make sure that you get credit for it, okay? Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. Enough of this for a minute, okay? On the web, kopn.org. Go there. Please help us. As my son says, give us some money. We need your money. Please help us. All right? All right. To everybody at, you know, now, okay, I also have to give, you know, props to my friends at Cosmic Waves Radio. We've been streaming the show there since May of last year. I've sort of been pirating the waves over there for the last 7 months, 8 months. But thanks to everyone who makes it happen live and on the radio. Through the traditional waves or on the web. So thanks to everybody who makes that happen at KOPN and at Cosmic Waves, everybody. I love you all, and thank you for appreciating what I do and helping me do it, okay? I got notes coming from everyone here. I hope for a little bit of time to call a friend and watch. Oh, I shouldn't be saying this out loud.
Would you like my song journal and diary? Right here?
Let me just read all your mail, everything, okay? All right, hold on. Yes, that'd be great, actually. But just hold on a second, all right? Elise, you know, all right, just, you know, for those of you who think that I'm nuts, I'm not. I've got a lot of information coming at me, and I'm just trying to deal, all right? Anyway, we got good stuff coming from you, from me, from you, from everyone, money, music, information. So hop on the web, go to kopn.org, or go to my site, mikehagan.com. You'll have access to everything that I'm doing over there. Take a look and see. Let us know what's going on. And I'll peek into the chat room as well. We've got a live chat going right now. I'm sure there are people in there that are listening to me and talking about what a goof I am or something. But you guys, too, you know, out there, most of my listeners are on the web. I have very few listeners around Columbia. I'm sort of invisible around here, lucky for me. But, you know, you guys that are listening over the web, now you can listen to the stream officially from KOPN. And I think the bit rate is a bit higher. I'd actually be interested in hearing people let me know what they think of the difference between the stream that they normally hear on Cosmic Waves and the stream that you're hearing on from the KOPN website, because, you know, the quality should be different. I actually stream the show on Cosmic Waves at a pretty low bit rate, like 24 kilobytes, and I do that for people that are dial-up or whatever, and that have a difficult time, you know, getting data over their telephone lines or something like that. But for the people that are listening to KOPN stream, I'd really be interested in hearing from you what it sounds like, if the quality's better. And you can just maybe drop me an email or pop a note up there on the chat page or whatever. So, and it'd be interesting for us over here because we're trying to figure out this whole business, all right? My email address, by the way, orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, at AOL.com. On the web, Mike Hagan, H-A-G-A-N.com. And the phone number here in the studio, if you do want to give us a call, you can do it when Elise is jamming out here. And it's 573-874-5676 or 1-800-895-5676. I would prefer that if you're going to make a pledge, though, if you just do that online, just because I don't have a whole lot of time here and there's nobody helping in the middle of the night right now, and it'd just be easier if you did it that way. You're all online anyway. I know most of the people that are listening to the program have their computers on, so that'd probably be the best way. Just put Orbit in the comment line or something so people know that you donated, you know, for this program. Okay? All right. Upcoming guests tonight, John J. Harper, the author of Transformers, Shamans of the 21st Century. He's amazing and a very interesting guy who I came across. Actually, a long time ago, I read some of John J. Harper's material probably 2 or 3 years ago, but just recently sort of got it together with him. So tonight we'll have him on the air in just about 25 minutes, and it'll be great. He's real interesting and very articulate and can talk about a lot of the things that we're interested in talking about in this program. So stick around for that. If you want to get a leg up, hop on the web and just go to johnjharper.com. That's John, J-O-H-N-J, J-A-Y, Harper, H-A-R-P-E-R, johnjharper.com. All right, you can see what he's about. Next week, I'm so psyched. The amazing Paul Laffoley, this incredible artist. I was excited when I interviewed Alex Gray. Let me tell you, Paul Laffoley, I'm blown away. Absolutely blown away. He'll be on the program next week. I got some great music lined up to accompany the interview. And I'm sort of at a loss for words, but we'll let Paul talk about himself and the things that he's done and is doing next week. But on the web, again, just look up Paul Laffoley, L-A-F-F-O-L-E-Y, or go to my site. You can see a link to him, or I think it's Laffoley.com or .org, or I don't know. He's easy to find these days. But really excited about the program next week with Paul Laffoley, and just absolutely honored that he's going to be on the show. You know, he's never done a radio interview before. He's done a couple of things. He did a couple of like short 8-minute pieces with disinformation.com that are video pieces, which are really cool. And he's been talked about at length via the written word. Lots of people write about him and talk about his work. He's absolutely visionary. And anyway, he's going to be on the program. I asked him if, you know, he's in Boston, and I asked him as a courtesy, when I ever do programs with people on the East Coast, I offer to start the interviews at the beginning of the program at 11 o'clock our time as opposed to midnight, because I usually start them at midnight and do the first hour sort of by myself, you know. But whenever I do an East Coast interview, I always offer the guest the opportunity to begin right at the beginning of the program so they don't have to stay up so late. And Paul said, well, yeah, that's great. I'd love to start right at the beginning of the program, but I want to go all 3 hours. So it's going to be, I'm sure, a really, really fun and interesting and exciting show next week, and I'm really excited about it if you guys aren't. So hopefully that spills over to you, and you'll join us again next week for Paul Laffoley. And it'll give you another reason to send a few dollars our way, okay? What else we have? Judith Ann Brown, the daughter of John Marco Allegro. My God. On the 19th of February, the daughter of John Marco Allegro, the author of lots of different books, the Dead Sea Scrolls, you know, the Ancient Origins of Christianity, the Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. Judith's book, his daughter, wrote a book called John Marco Allegro, The Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And for people who aren't familiar with John Marco Allegro, he, in 1956 through 1960, was one of the four original team members assigned by the Vatican, believe it or not, to decipher, translate, and further excavate the Dead Sea Scrolls. And John Marco Legro in 1957 was a rock star. He was on the cover of Time magazine. He was considered as cool as they come. And the reason was because on this planet, he was the main man that understood the languages of Aramaic and Coptic and the ancient Sumerian texts and Assyrian and Hebrew. And so when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in Qumran in Jordan in the late 1940s, it took some years before anybody even knew what happened. And Judith will tell the whole story in a couple weeks. But when they were actually realized by the scientific community, John Marco Allegro was the natural choice of everyone. Everyone knew that this was the guy that needed to be involved with the research and investigation into the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, John Marco Allegro did investigate the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the information that he revealed about them was unpalatable to the powers that be. And his story is a really interesting one. And it's not unprecedented, you know. There are lots of people like this in history who were, amazing intellects and intelligences who were discredited eventually because of their positions or their views, just because they said things the way that they saw them. You know, Royal Raymond Rife comes to mind right off the bat, Nikola Tesla, Immanuel Velikovsky, Wilhelm Reich, Hans Russell, you know, brings a tear to my eye, Grandfather Wallace, Nicholas Black Elk, Rudolf Steiner, John Marco Allegro, all right? So, that's right, KOPN, all right, and Radio Orbit, all right? So anyway, we'll have Judith Ann Brown, again, another woman who's never been interviewed before. And thank you to Jan Irvin and Andrew Ritaji for introducing me to Judith, because she's wonderful. And anyway, you guys will love that. Trust me, it's in 2 weeks. Judith Ann Brown, the daughter of John Marco Allegro, and the author of The Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls. All right, the 26th of February, sort of open. Not sure what'll come in there. I'm talking to Paul Stamets. Everyone's been asking me to interview Paul Stamets, and I've been trying for a couple of years. And he's really busy, and he doesn't do a lot of this stuff, but I think we're going to be able to do it. So anyway, Paul Stamets, speaking of mushrooms, right, the worldwide expert on growing them, Paul Stamets, the author of Mycelium Running, and many other books, but, you know, the Mushroom Cultivator and many other books. And, of course, he's, you know, Paul's being consulted by the United States government these days because they recognize, or at least some people recognize that and I'm not just talking about psychedelic mushrooms here. I'm talking about the mushroom in general. Mushrooms are amazing, and they have a lot of things to offer as a symbiotic partner to human beings, including cleaning up a lot of our messes and our toxic waste dumps and this sort of thing. But mushrooms are great for medicine. They're great for food. They're great for cleaning up the environment. And they're also great for opening up your mind to see what's really going on around you. So anyway, Paul Stamets, an absolute icon in the field of mycology. Hopefully, I'm crossing my fingers. We've been chatting for the last couple of days, but I think we're going to get it together. We'll have him on the program sometime, certainly this year, and hopefully, you know, in the springtime. Okay? Who else? Eric John Phelps, for the conspiracy-minded of you out there. We'll talk about the Vatican, the Jesuits, and all that gang. Jose Arguelles, Dr. Jose Arguelles, author of The Mayan Factor and, you know, Time in the Technosphere. Another just an icon if you're interested in, you know, the archaic revival in South American shamanism. Ralph Metzner, another icon in this field, will be on the program on the 5th of March. Ralph Metzner. I actually talked to Ralph Metzner last week. It took me 3 years just to send him an email. And you know what? I did. And he said, thank you for inviting me on your radio program.
It didn't take 3 years to get there, though.
No, it didn't. But it took me 3 years to get my courage up to approach him, because he's, for me, such a, it's like giving Christ a call, you know, to some people. Maybe not that.
It took 3 years to get there. That deferred, I mean, you know.
Oh, no, he's perfectly available. I just didn't have the courage to do it. Anyway, Dr. Dennis, I talked to Dennis today. He's doing great. He's in Vancouver. He'll be back on the program in April, hopefully, and lots of other things. So I'm going to take a break here. I'm going to ask everybody out there again to consider KOPN when you think about your donations, when you think about the money that you consider for charities and for nonprofits and for this sort of thing. It's a great cause. There's great things happening here, and you can be a part of it. And I encourage everyone to get in here. Come on down here. The doors are open, except when Will's there. But, you know, come on down, and we'll have fun, and you can get involved at the station and be a part of this amazing resource in mid-Missouri here that is strong but sort of singular. And I encourage everyone to learn about it and to get involved, all right? Okay, I got to make a phone call here. I got to get John on the telephone, so I'm going to have Elise play another tune for us here.
Okay.
Or do a little piece of spoken word, whatever she'd like to do. I'm going to need probably 3 or 4 minutes out of you, though, so make it last. And I'll get John on the phone. We'll come back. I don't know if I'll do space weather or not. I got a couple announcements I need to make. We'll see. And then we'll come back with John J. Harper at the top of the hour, okay? On the web, johnjharper.com. I'm on the web at Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. And KOPN, of course, at KOPN.org. And it should be very simple if you go to KOPN.org to figure out how to donate a few of your dollars to help us out to support Radio Orbit and to support this amazing radio station. Elise, Brian, everybody, should be playing the Blue Fugue on Friday, is that right?
Yeah, it's this Friday, the Blue Fugue with Noah Earle.
With Noah Earle, wonderful.
And things will start 8:30-ish. Yeah, yeah. The only thing I want to tack on about that is that set for that night only from me will be Subtropical Goddess. And you'll just have to come and see what kind of color festivity is involved with that.
All right. Friday, the 9th?
Yes, the 9th.
Friday, the 9th of February, the Blue Fugue, the Subtropical Goddess. My friend Elise Brian. Do it up, huh?
Why are they all surprised when they're seeing us changes? Sub-zero degrees in San Diego, cumulative abuse to a mother is gonna show itself somehow. And here I sit in another Missouri freeze, the bones of their crispy branches putting my skeleton at ease. Cause my roots are alive, even though Gaia speaks destruction, creation, destruction, creation. And I'm walking this manifestation. They are talking about the truth for restoration. After bombing family, spiritual culture, and a land that hasn't even been a nation for so, 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 so long. Is there some work on democracy or corporal militant hegemony on uber ballistic Darth Vader breathing a comic tsunami? Yeah. Government and corporation equals more jails and underfunded public schools. So this fatty few who be the crew on Wall Street at Halliburton, peeking at the Pentagon satellite ray, specking what kind of panties you got on. Come on, come on, come on, come on. Get your freaky, peace-filled, expressive revolution going on to cultivate some real solutions. It ain't dark and doom-dumb. Gonna groove the world, letting dreams unfurl. We're gonna start right here in this room. Yeah, I'll give you some of this. You can share some of that. We'll find a smooth way to remedy vibration that's whack.
Very nice. Everybody, Elise Brion, you can catch her live this weekend on Friday night at the Blue Fugue. And I think, what did you say? With Noah Earle.
Yeah.
Who's a friend of mine. I love Noah. And I've been trying to get Noah to come on the program. He's so busy, though. He's always all over the place. And he's a super committed musician. I mean, he just really works hard. And he's also a great guitarist and a great writer and a great vocalist.
I feel like adding something about Mr. Noah.
Please.
He's also a personal friend, and I think it's magical that he's very much dedicated to the art and the beauty and the love of music, and he keeps it earthy and rooted and like friendly, and that's just awesome within the industry. But that goes on into different digressions.
No doubt, but Noah's great, and that'll be a great show on Friday at the Fugue with Elise and Noah. If you haven't heard Noah, definitely worth checking out. You're hearing Elise tonight. We'll hear one more from her probably in the next couple minutes before the top of the hour here. I'll do a quick KOPN plug on the web, kopn.org. It's Pledge Drive Week. As my son says, oh, hold on, let's do it again. Here it is. Check this out.
You're listening to Radio A Bit on the Air, KOPN, Columbia, Missouri. 89.5 FM. Fun Drive. Give us some money. We need some money. Please, help us. Thank you.
All right, there you go. We need some money. Help us. Thank you. That's really all I have to say. All right? If you think this program is worthwhile, if you think KOPN is worth your while, you know, put us in the budget, if you know what I'm saying. All right, it's Mike. You're listening to KOPN Radio Orbit on the web at kopn.org. You can donate there. I'd appreciate it if you do. If you don't, keep listening anyway. In about 7 minutes, John J. Harper. Check him out on the web, johnjharper.com. Not the letter J, the word J, as in Blue J. John, J-O-H-N-J-A-Y, Harper.com. And you can link there directly from my site, of course. We'll have him in just a few minutes here. We'll have another song from Elise in a few as well. And let me look real fast. I was going to do space weather. I don't have to. But go outside and look up at the stars tonight. You'll be able to see Saturn rising behind the moon. You'll also see Mercury, Saturn, and Venus all in the sky at the same time right now. You got real clear. Even though it's cold, you got great clear skies right now. So it's really... One of the benefits of the cold is to be able to have great stargazing. And there's lots of great things above you in the wintertime right now. If you haven't noticed, Orion is rising up nicely above us every night now in the wintertime. And Venus looking beautiful. And the moon just full a couple days ago. So lots of light out there right now, even though it's a little bit chilly. And a good time to go take a look up in the sky. Comet McNaught, also in the southern hemisphere, is still a naked eye comet. If you can believe that, it's been, what, going on 4 weeks now? I mean, one of the most amazing things that's happened in the heavens in my lifetime, certainly, you know, it just shows you where the press is. It shows you that, you know, the revolution won't be televised.
And just nobody even knew it was there. It's like this remarkable, amazing thing, this beautiful, angelic thing. And, you know, unless you were really paying attention, you didn't even see it. But, anyway, what else?
I want to talk with you about music.
Please.
And I've got curiosity questions for you.
Oh, wow. See, now I'm getting interviewed.
Well, and whatever we got, 5 minutes time. Or
yeah, do it.
I'm really interested in talk and actually just the activation of the piecework, the like upliftingness of what music can bring. Mm. And I feel very strongly that you know, where your heart is, where your mind is, and especially if you're an artist, and not just of course if you're an artist, that there is just amazing power that surges through us, you know. And or that we can be open to, and with music, it's just, I mean, it's a tool. It's a tool and so much more. I'm curious what you might think or have to say on any of that.
Well, I think that you're right. I think music in particular and art in general is what we need to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the answer to fascism and the answer to, you know, war and destruction and all that is not to fight against it. It's to do art, you know? Because it seems to me that whenever you fight against something, you basically empower it. In other words, you know, the neocons are worthless without the extremist Muslims. I mean, they both need each other to exist, right? So that tension and that... And that's maybe a current example, but it's not new, you know. I just use that because it's something that we're familiar with talking about these days. But, you know, the idea of fighting against is just one that that is cyclical, and it just sort of maintains itself. Art really fights against nothing. It just says, here I am, look at me, you know. And I think that's great. I'm sitting here with two wonderful artists. My friend Will in the corner here is one of the most amazing photographers around, and not just around here. another wonderful musician sitting across from me here. These are artists, all you guys. And John J. Harper, who's going to be on the air with me here in 3 minutes. You know, he's an artist. And my program, I try to think of it as art. The reason that I include music and poetry and literature, and the reason I talk about people that are outside of the scope of science and technology or whatever, is because I sort of look at the whole thing as art. And so I guess that's my answer, is that yes, you are so right that art and music, in your case, is it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think we should play another song.
Oh, okay.
All right, why don't you play another one for us? We'll talk another minute at the top of the hour here about what you're doing in the next week or two. You have another show at Cafe Berlin, I think, in 2 weeks.
Actually, it's the 10th. It's the night after.
All right, so the 9th
show.
And the 10th, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, and we'll let people know a little bit about that in just a minute again, but play one more for us, okay? And then we'll have John J. Harper, everybody, in just a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And while Elise is playing her lovely tune, you can zip on over to kopn.org and let us know how much you appreciate it. All right? All right, everybody. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, and this is Elise Brion. You can check her out tomorrow, actually on Friday night at the Blue Fugue, and on Saturday at Cafe Berlin.
I want to say that the album that I have called La Hora Ahora, which is the Now Hour. It's got a lot of a cappella stuff, and there's additions that's going to have, you know, samples and loops and contributing musicians to back up. So some of the things I've been doing tonight are, you know, representative of the album. I'm a doula, and my music is infused with reflections on body power and what women can do. This one is your ancient center. You go to your ancient center, ow. You breathe the way your soul sings, deep, 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 deep. So low you feel your head being tickled by the roots of a grandmother tree. What medicine changes pain to intensity?
You stride light alive toward all the tigerish fields, muddling up your mental stains on the inside. They disintegrate, recycled into another love template to empower your being. Freeing sister, freeing brother, God is on high, we need and think of mother. Freeing sister, freeing brother, God is on high, we need and think of mothers. Generations of women not telling their stories, just how did they give birth? Twilight sleep, scalpels running sleek, strange men in white coats saying you can't eat, moan, groan. Your contractions are timed, your labor finite. If you pass that point, straight to C-section and fluorescent lights. Sister, squat and reclaim your might. Let your grandmothers hear your low tones. Surrender to your body flow. Your rushes are gonna take you to a cosmically indescribable place. Bless your birthing space. The power you feel now recreates the anguish of the past. Your baby's a sanctified soul on its way to unscroll the divine script of peace that you yourself began to unroll. Freeing sister, freeing brother, God is on high, we need instinctive mothers. Freeing sister, freeing brother, God is on high, we need instinctive mothers.
Elise Brion, it's Mike, you listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Elise, thank you so much.
Yay.
I'll talk to you soon, okay? Everybody, Elise Brion, you can catch her on Friday at the Blue Fugue, on Saturday at Cafe Berlin. I'll be back with you in just a moment. It's KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM.
You're listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
You are listening to KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's Mike Hagan, and it's Radio Orbit. John J. Harper is a clinical hypnotherapist. He's a futurist, a research scientist. He runs a non-for-profit that's dedicated to helping us come up with solutions and foresee emerging crises in climate, culture, consciousness, many different things. He's a guy that's got his hands in all kinds of different pies, and we're going to check out a couple of those interests tonight with him, and we're going to begin right now and say hello and welcome John J. Harper to Radio Orbit. Thanks so much for being here, John.
Thank you, Mike, for the invitation.
You're welcome. It's great to have you here on the program, and I've got your book in my hand here, and I got a bunch of dog ears on it.
That's always good news for a writer.
Yeah, I actually read them, you know.
That is unusual.
I actually do read them. But this is an amazing book, and your story is a really interesting one. And what I like to do usually with, of course, this is the first time we've been on the air together, I like to have people tell a little bit about their story, and yours is a really interesting one. So let's start off with a little bit about yourself. And, of course, you had a transformative experience as well, what, maybe 17, 18 years ago, I guess it was?
Yeah, it was actually back in the late 80s, and real briefly, my background was I joined the military right out of school and ended up at the U.S. Army Missile Command in Huntsville, Alabama, and went through their program in basically it was basic electronics, the early days of computer science, and then missile electronics, and then subsequently found myself stationed in Nuremberg, West Germany at the time. This is late 60s, early 70s, mm-hmm. and through that experience, I met a real good friend from Louisiana who was had gone to LSU and then been drafted into the Army, and as so many of my unit was a very special unit. It was called the 116th Ordnance Detachment, and it was a group of guys. There was no gals back in those days. Most of them were college grads. A lot of them had been drafted right out of getting their master's or PhD, actually. And so they formed this kind of elite unit of enlisted guys who basically refused their officer commission. During Vietnam, this was the height of Vietnam, a lot of these guys were mathematicians and engineers and scientists, and and they really didn't want to tote a rifle in the jungles of Vietnam if they could help it. Right away, you would say they were probably pretty bright folks. And so we found ourselves over in a unique situation over in Bavaria, and we set up this new missile outfit, and I served about a year and a half overseas. We had some marvelous experiences, good times, but very standard, you know, had a real kind of a normal way of looking at the world at that time. I was very into science and mathematics and electronics in particular, and I got out of the service as my friend George Begay, who's going to now come into the story a little bit more. George was from Plaquemine, Louisiana, and when he was drafted, like I say, he and I found ourselves forming a close friendship in Huntsville, and then we both married in Huntsville, Alabama in the late 60s, 1969.
Right, your wife is Connie.
Connie, and Connie actually, since we got some central Missouri folks, I know we're on the internet and around the planet, but my wife's from Independence, Missouri, so a plug for Independence.
Yeah, you've had, there are some, and we'll get to it later, but there's some references to Missouri in your book, actually. So.
Yes, I had an experience we'll talk about later that involved Mount Rainier that actually led to where I'm living now, which is in the Spokane, Washington area. But briefly, Mike, what happened to me was I formed this friendship with my friend who, again, was a brilliant mathematician and physicist, George Begay, and George... he and I worked side by side for a while with the Defense Department, and then suddenly in November of 1987, it was a Monday morning, and he died suddenly of a massive heart attack. And he actually did so in his doctor's office in Huntsville, Alabama, and it just threw, of course, his immediate family. He had two daughters at the time, his wife and myself. And all the folks that knew George well just threw us for a loop because it was so sudden, you know.
And a young man, right?
Young man, age 40. And, you know, we had the big Alabama-LSU football game that prior weekend and, you know, the big party situation. So everything was, you know, kind of like the Super Bowl weekend for us down there in the southeast at the time. And so it was quite a shock. I mean, he wasn't sick and he did not have any symptoms. He just suddenly died from a massive heart attack, and so I got this call. He died at 9:30 on a Monday morning, and I got a call probably about 11 o'clock that morning, and from his wife, who said, "John, I've got some really bad news," and went into her, you know, early grief cycle, and I became a pallbearer at that very elaborate Catholic funeral, and it was quite stunning an experience for me, and left quite an impression. Well, let's fast forward a little bit. I really, I just had a hard time coping with his loss because we were that close of friends. We did everything together, and because we were both kind of, geeks in the science sense, we really, could talk the stuff. And so, I mean, we did a lot of things, outside of work and on the weekends, and we were always building circuitry or talking about physics or this, the cosmos at large. We had these very big philosophical discussions. And the point is that when I lost him, I told my wife Connie, I said, I just can't go on here. I really need to go back where I grew up. I want to get grounded again. I'm losing my sense of identity, my sense of what it's all about, because my friend was, and Connie felt the same way about George and his wife and kids and stuff. And we have three children, actually, all adult kids now, but we have two daughters, and they had two daughters. So, again, it was really a tight family situation. So, anyway, I put in for a transfer to the U.S. Navy. I was working for the Army at the time, and this is during Ronald Reagan years, during the SDI, Star Wars program.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was pretty high-tech stuff going on. And I went with the Navy at the Naval Undersea Warfare Center, Keyport, Washington. That's over across from Seattle. We paint you a little picture here on the Olympic Peninsula. I grew up there, a little town called Silverdale, Washington. Very scenic, you know. You look out your window on a good day, and there's Mount Rainier. And, it's just a very beautiful, natural, national park kind of setting there. But anyway, so George died in November of 1987. And this was about middle spring, I guess, of 88. And everything was fine. I was, adjusting to a new job as an electronics engineer, working in the software engineering field for the Navy, and everything was cool, and I wasn't really thinking about anything. That June morning, 1988, about 4 a.m., I had what can you say, but you just have an experience that just rocks you to your core, changes your entire outlook on life in an instant. And what happened was, I saw my friend George stand at the foot of my bed. My wife was sound asleep. The sun was just coming up that early June morning, and I thought I was having a lucid dream. I mean, I was kind of in and out of this state of consciousness that I later realized was what we call the classical trance state and of a shaman. Hence the name of my book, Transformer, Shamans of the 21st Century, because I came to realize, later that during the research and all that, that I think we're really all going to be going into this state of consciousness, so I want to just kind of throw that in at the moment. But what I saw was my friend standing there, in essence, in front of me, and as I shook the cobwebs out of my head, the vision or the image became stronger, and now, of course, I have words for it. I realized it was a holographic projection, and that I was in a state of consciousness that where I could kind of be in this three-dimensional realm that we exist in, and also in that state of consciousness that where I believe the paranormal, the spiritual, the metaphysical experiences that people talk about, they happen. And so I was kind of, baptized by fire, as we say, into this metaphysical realm, and it changed my worldview forever.
It's really funny that, and I mean funny, strange, and sort of funny, ha-ha, I guess, but the way that you describe the experience is so common, not in exact details, but the point of sort of the experience. In other words, you can hear it all day, and you can hear people talk about, this happened to me, and, the light came into my room, or I was, I drew down the flying saucer, or whatever. But until it happens to you, it's just, even if you're a reasonable skeptic, you accept the fact that it's possible. But then when it happens to you, you go, oh my.
Yeah, even more so for me. I mean, because I was so left brain and so entrenched in the science says model of reality, and unless someone with a PhD blessed my perception to that point, it didn't really exist, I guess, kind of a quick metaphor, it's like, watching something on the sci-fi channel and then end up finding yourself on CNN reporting a UFO. I mean, like you say, until it happens to you, it goes from being in another category of existence. And, we hear so many people today talking about metaphysical experiences. We talk about angels and near-death experiences and UFOs, and on it goes. And, back in the late 80s especially, there wasn't a whole lot of chit-chat about this on the mainstream. There was no television shows, per se, about this. It was all in the sci-fi realm, if it existed at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for me, it was just a tremendous shock. And that's what led to doing about 15 years worth of real serious research, and along the way having even more and more experiences, and then recollecting some that I had as a child that seemed to fit into this new paradigm, this new model of reality that I was uncovering or rediscovering. And so, when I look back, it's a whole picture, but trust me, I didn't have a clue most days what was going on. It was just that dramatic. And now, you know, as I can understand the science and I'm starting to reintegrate all of it back together so I can speak more coherently today about it, but that's why it took me so long to write my book, because I kept rewriting it and rewriting it to the point where even I could understand what I said.
Well, you know, I can't believe this comes to my mind, but I'm actually paging through the beginning of your book. And one of the reasons I love it is because you have so many great dedications in it, too. There's all kinds of great quotes, and there's all kinds of great references to people who obviously were influences upon you and great, you know, edge runners like Terrence McKenna, who was one of my friends. And I just opened the page to Terrence here, you know.
Yes.
And it just makes me think about how unlikely situations tend to just throw themselves your way, you know. And the people that that are willing to actually look at them in a skeptical manner, but also open-mindedly. You know, Terrence was a complete skeptic.
Yes.
But he was open-minded, and he believed that if you were open-minded and a skeptic and then went out on the fringes, you know, and looked at things that were, you know, off the main body of the river and off on the tributaries and in the middle of the Amazon or wherever, then you really would meet the unimaginable, and then you come up with the exact same thing.
Well, yeah, in fact, what you end up doing is realizing that we live and move and have our being in this gigantic field of energy that is consciousness, that is information. And, of course, this is good physics today, but, you know, it's taken a long time to get there.
Mm-hmm.
The quantum physics model, which was really hatched about 100-plus years ago,
right.
is only now coming into the mainstream, you know, conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the scientists couldn't even handle what they discovered. You know?
Exactly. You know, I could have this conversation, say, in a laboratory setting, which I worked for many, many years, and it was very obvious that we were talking about things that were non-physical, that it was a kind of a, you know, a segue into the religious community. But those conversations would be cut short more often than not. And at 5 o'clock, when the whistle blew, so to speak, nothing was ever said, you know, at the social, at the cocktail hour.
Right, right.
Right?
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is. And it was a split life existence. And it is for many people today. You know, I mean, the religious community is just as bad. So let's whack them a good one, too, you know. I mean, they do their stuff on Sunday from 11 to 12.
Right.
And then most of them don't either do it or practice it or talk about it, or they don't even know the source of the ideas that they talk about.
Isn't it the truth? You know, I've got a friend of mine who's up there in Seattle, Washington. You may be familiar. He's on the show here sometimes. His name is Kent Stedman. He runs a website called Cyberspace Orbit. But anyway, he's got a young son, who's in his 20s, and he's a research guy from Microsoft, right?
Yeah.
And I'm friends with him, and he tells me, he says, Mike, we come up with things all the time that the in other words, the engineers like him, he said, we come up with things all the time that the mathematicians and the physics guys don't have a theory for. In other words, they're doing things all the time that are completely outside of all known theory.
Exactly. That shows that information drives consciousness, which drives reality. And, you know, it's really tough to wrap your mind around that idea that ideas or information is what creates physical matter. And we're getting to that point now in physics that, you know, we see that intention, that our, as my good colleague Dr. Bruce Lipton talks about, the biology of belief.
Right, right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're really coming full circle back into this idea, maybe in Genesis, where, you know, God says, you know, let there be light, and there was light, and that light is densely packed information, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get this other classic quote in the New Testament about from John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Well, the Word is a vibration or, you know, a certain frequency of information that's created all of reality. And, you know, in the Asian community, if you talk about this with a Taoist or, you know, with others who have a kind of a non-rigid approach to reality, this is common knowledge for thousands of years. So here in the West, I mean, it's like, you know, we're just getting kind of a wake-up call that the physics community can really now maybe breathe deeply, and they need to share more often with us that, hey, you know, this stuff's coming full circle again, you know, and we need to wake up to the idea that we're co-creating reality. We are co-participants, as some physicists say, and others have said, you know, the universe is no longer a great machine. It's a great thought.
Wow. All right, well, you said a couple things here we need to follow up on. First one, Bruce Lipton. I was surprised and thrilled, actually, when I read the foreword to your book. I didn't realize that he had written the foreword, but he's wonderful, and he writes a nice little intro to your book. Maybe you could talk a little bit about Bruce Lipton and your relationship with him.
Yeah, Bruce Lipton and I came across each other through actually doing some talk radio out of Seattle with Laura Lee back in the 90s. And
yeah, Laura Lee, hats off to her. She was doing this stuff a long time ago, and she was great, and she still is doing great stuff.
Cutting edge. I mean, she's just a tremendous human being, and her husband Paul's been extremely supportive. And you know, she has brought so many folks to the tips of our tongue in the general population. I mean, I remember, you know, sitting around the coffee table, so to speak, you know, with folks like Richard Hoagland and Greg Braden,
right.
And so on and so forth. Rick Levine,
right.
I think you've had on your show, right?
Yeah, he's a friend. He's been on the show a couple times.
Yeah, he's super individual.
Oh, he's awesome. Yeah.
He's awesome.
Yeah.
And so, but Bruce Lipton was one of those people that, you know, he was down in the Bay Area and actually zipping around the country even way back when, start talking about the biology of belief. And
again, a Ph.D., very well-respected gentleman, Bruce Lipton is.
Ph.D. from University of Virginia.
Virginia.
And he taught medical school at the University of Wisconsin. Then he went and actually joined the research staff at Stanford University
mm-hmm.
School of Medicine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then after that, he did that for a few years, but then he really had to break out of that mainstream because he just couldn't go anywhere with it. It was so constrictive of an environment. You know, and after he had painstakingly showed, you know, in the laboratory setting that, you know, that there was something going on there with consciousness and information and a belief system about, you know, what we were to expect from our experiments. But when he got all that sorted out inside, you know, and he knew he couldn't keep going in the mainstream and the orthodox scientific community with this without continually butting heads with folks, you know, he just opted out and eventually ended up teaching medical school in the Caribbean, you know, in one of these offshore programs. But the point is that when I started listening to Laura Lee interview Bruce Lipton in the early days, I said, this is my kind of guy, and this is important to the research I'm doing for my book, and I got to get a hold of him, and I did, and we started having hours of conversation, and, you know, he would call me, and I would call him, and then finally I said, okay, Bruce, this is it. You got to come here to Spokane. So I set up a speaking engagement for him like I've done for Greg Braden and others.
Right.
And so I go out and I bait the hook and I throw the line 1,000 miles and I reel them in here. You know?
Hey, I sort of do the same thing.
Yeah, you do. Absolutely. Sure. This is a great gig. You know, we just go fishing in the deep water, you know, and we pull up some amazing catches once in a while.
Well, I'll tell you. You've done in print what I try to do on radio. You've made a great synthesis of lots and lots of different ideas and different people, and Bruce Lipton is certainly one of them. Let's talk a little bit before we're going to take a break in about 5 minutes, okay? But before we do that, you mentioned one other thing that struck me. You said things are coming around again, and let's talk a little bit about cycles and the idea of the turning of ages and this sort of thing.
Yeah, well, you know where I ended up, Mike, when I started looking at all this data and I started realizing that, wait a minute, now if consciousness and information is really driving, you know, creation itself, and I did come to that conclusion ultimately. It was very painful for me, but I did come there and got to stick around a while until I understood what was going on. But, you know, I realized that, wait a minute, the ancients have been saying this for a long, long time, long before history even really came into some type of written word. It was being taught, you know, through mythology, through spoken stories.
Right.
And So I started looking into mythology.
Through the word, by the way, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so what I did was, you know, and again, synchronicity kicked in, and I started bumping into a material that was just right down the center lane of where I was going with my own conclusions. And I came into Joseph Campbell's stuff with Bill Moyers.
Right on.
The power of myth. Sure. You know, public television.
How about it?
And so I bought that five-set series after I saw it on PBS, and I just, you know, even today, every winter I have a ritual where I go through all five volumes and revisit that material because it's so rich with ideas.
It is. It's amazing stuff.
And so, but kind of, again, kind of kick this up a notch in terms of where we're headed with this question that you've asked me. Overall, what I realized was I needed to go revisit the Egyptian civilization and the Mayans in particular.
Mm.
And then I started looking at the Bible a little differently, too, and I started realizing that it was talking about animals of the zodiac, and there was a lot of stuff in there, a lot of symbolism in the book of Revelation. And these things started popping up at me, and they actually became non-religious topics. They became very almost scientific, astronomical topics for discussion. And once I cracked the code on some of these symbols and the zodiac in particular, I realized, you know, there was a lot of stuff in the New Testament about, you know, 12 disciples and 12 signs of the times of the zodiac and, you know, this, you know, all these 12 things. You look at the face of a clock. We're talking about 12 hours of the day and 12 hours of the night, you know, when it's equal, you know, in equinoxes, that kind of stuff.
But, right. We got all these 12s.
You know, there's all kinds of things going on there and that have to do with the zodiac and looking at a 360-degree circle and segmenting that into time, both hours of the day and months of the 12 months of the year, you know. And all this kind of stuff that has to do with time. Well, who was the master of time in civilization? As we know it well, it was the Mayans, right? They were, as John Major Jenkins shares, you know, I have an appendix that he wrote for my book. And this is way back in the pretty early years, too. This stuff was, you know, way before John even got really rolling with his books and stuff. And so, again, here's this great synthesis going on at some level of consciousness, and I consider myself just kind of like a mannequin with a, you know, with a mouth that moves once in a while, eking out this kind of stuff. You know, as our brother Terrence McKenna would say, I'm the one that the cosmos has decided to English it for us again.
Right.
And so the thing of it is, though, that it can no longer be denied. I mean, we are entering into a shift of the ages, a completion of cycles within cycles, and that's why everybody's getting a little antsy about this, because we're seeing the weather change, and we're hearing prophecies, and we're hearing about end times, and we're hearing about the date, you know, December 21st, 2012. And I realized quite some years ago that there was really something important about this, and that it was ominous. That it is going to be catastrophic as it's going to be transformational. And what we have, of course, is kind of a, just like we have a climate debate, you know, is global warming, you know, man-made, or is it a natural cycle? Well, it's the same thing with 2012. You know, is it going to be just a shift in consciousness, or is it going to be, you know, somewhat cataclysmic in terms of Earth changes?
Right, well, physical accompaniment.
Yeah, and if we just stand back from that a moment and realize, you know, the Greeks and the Egyptians had a real handle on this when they said, you know, as above, so below, as within, so without. We need to pay attention, because if consciousness and information is what drives everything, well, you cannot change the human being and the animals and the plant kingdom without pumping information, the Kundalini type thing, through us. And that, of course, comes through the center of the Earth and then out into the north-south poles, electromagnetic field, the magnetosphere, and beyond to the sun, and beyond to the core of the Milky Way. So, you know, right away here, we just start making quantum leaps, if you will, you know, in our insights about what is going to be coming our way in order for us to go into a new level of consciousness.
Amazing. All right, John, let's take a little break there, okay?
You bet.
All right, everybody, let's take a little breather here. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. It's about 12:30. in the AM now on the 6th of February, 2007. Happy birthday to my sister Carol, by the way. A half hour now. What, 43, 44? How old are you? I don't know. She won't even let me say it on the air, probably. Even though she's in Florida. It's John J. Harper on the air with me. You can find him on the web at johnjharper.com. That's johnjayharper.com. You can connect there, obviously, from my site at mikehagan, HAGAN.com. And KOPN.org is the place you should be visiting if you want to listen to the live stream and hear this broadcast anywhere on the planet through your computer if you have an internet connection, or a reasonably good one, I guess. And you can also donate money to keep us doing this stuff. It's Pledge Drive Week here at KOPN. We have a couple times a year where we come to you, the listeners, and say, hey, help us out. If you like what you hear, if you like open-minded, non-corporatized, free speech radio, that you support KOPN and other stations like it. If there are none in your vicinity and you're listening to me over the web, it's a great reason for you to do it. You know, there used to be 300 and some odd community radio stations around the United States. And I think there are 32 left. Over 90% of them in the last 40 years. It really took off in the mid-60s, like so many things, and the 70s, and peaked shortly thereafter, and then was a slow decline until a rapid decline happened with the consolidation of media, you know, in the 90s. And literally, community public radio stations, you know, that are not sponsored by big giant corporations and that are commercial-free. If you've noticed, we're not playing commercials tonight other than me yapping a little bit about, you know, begging for money. And we do have some underwriting sponsors, but for the most part, it's commercial-free. And you can't get it anywhere else. And there's nowhere else I could do this program. So I urge you to consider it when you think about a place to put some of your money. And the easy way to do it is just go to the web, kopn.org, and go to the donation section of the website and pledge your support, become a member of KOPN. There's lots of other great programs on the air as well, not just Orbit. And even if you don't like this program and you're just driving through town and there's nothing else on, you know, there are lots of other great things other than this program. And I urge you and hope that you'll take a look at KOPN when it comes to places to share some of your money. I know it's hard these days. I know a lot of people you know, are having a difficult time, especially people that listen to this radio station. So I understand, and I appreciate it, and, you know, just do what you can, but recognize we're doing everything we can here to, you know, to get information and entertainment and good music and good art to all y'all as best we can, okay? All right, it's Mike, and you're listening to Radio Orbit. We got John J. Harper. We'll come back to him in just a minute. I've got to go grab a little glass of water. Got some more great music here. We're going to shift gears a little bit. This is a band called The Feed that I was introduced to a few weeks ago. They're from St. Louis. Great stuff. Three-man band, keyboards, saxophone, and drums. Check it out. You won't believe what they do with those three.
We've been through this before.
Feed. That one's called Glue Man. I love it. Good music from St. Louis. And a couple, three guys there actually making some great music. I'll play a few more from the Feed in the next hour and a half here. Actually, I don't know if anyone's coming in at 2 a.m. tonight to do the shift after me. If they don't, I might just hang around and play some music. And I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. But anyway, between now and then, we will talk some more with John J. Harper. And, John, I apologize for the delay there.
Not a problem at all.
All right. Thank you for sticking around with us. John is talking to us live from his place in Spokane, or outside of Spokane, right?
Right. Spokane, Washington, right here from the Canadian border.
All right. Beautiful up there, actually.
You bet.
Man, well, you know, I'm going to take a left turn. We were talking off the air yesterday about this whole deal with Mount Rainier and the West Coast and the earthquake tsunami alert and all that. What the hell is going on?
Well, you know, part of these great cycles that occur on this planet to restore its health, I believe, involve these things that we call natural disasters. You know, we have these tremendous storms that come in on the oceans, both Pacific, Atlantic, and elsewhere, and on the surface. But, you know, underneath the ocean floor, that's where the majority of your volcanic activity is going on. That's how you create new land. You know, there's a huge incubator process, a big conveyor belt going on under these oceans. And right now, if these cycles and shifts of the ages where a lot of prophets, a lot of mystics, a lot of shamans have told us, you know, be ready, you know, to change your zip code real quick if you need to. And so these are one of those times. And, you know, when I was traveling back in the 90s to Kirksville, Missouri for a job interview, as I shared in my book, that I woke up again about 4 a.m. with a very profound visionary experience that, again, shocked me. But, you know, here about, 6 years prior, I had this event with my friend George, and I had a couple other major revelations in between these times. So, again, I was somewhat prepared, but not really. They come out of a bolt out of the blue, as we say, like being like struck with lightning. And in this one experience I had there in Missouri, in northeast Missouri, when I woke up that morning in my motel room trying to prepare for a job interview, I saw Mount Rainier detonate. I mean, it just was a massive explosion. You know, we can think of Mount St. Helens when it went out in May of 1980.
Mm-hmm.
I was not here at that time. I was actually working for Naval Weapons Center in China Lake, California. But my brothers were up here, and I had quite a story shared with me then about how they were like maybe 100 and some miles from that explosion, yet it rocked the cafe that they were having breakfast in that morning at about 8:32 a.m., if I remember correctly, on a Sunday. Well, the point is, I had something like that happen to me, only I knew it was Mount Rainier. I grew up at the base of Mount Rainier. I was born in Seattle. I went to school up through high school years at the base of Mount Rainier, a little town called Pacific City, Washington. And so I again immediately realized that this was an event that was at some point in the future. I didn't think it was imminent. I thought I was being shown the future. And so, you know, the normal thing is, well, maybe that's 50 years from now, 100 years from now. Yes, indeed, it could be, but I don't think so. And I realized that as I went through the research with my book, that there would be warnings. I actually knew this, Mike. I was given this piece of knowledge that listened for the scientific community to warn you that there was going to be a catastrophic earthquake off the Cascadia subduction zone area. At that time, back in the 1994, when I had this experience, I didn't even have words, the geological words, to express this. But as I came back to Seattle and decided not to move to Missouri, I said, I'm going to pack our bags as soon as I can and move inland to Spokane.
Mm.
And that's a kind of quite a story, too. We won't have time tonight, but my wife and I went to Missouri, and we went all over Pennsylvania, and we went down south, and we went all over looking for areas for me to retire, because I decided to go ahead and take early retirement, which I did in June of 93, actually. So when I had this experience in June of 94 in Missouri, I had just served as a vice principal of my old high school, actually, and I decided not to renew the contract, but I said, I'm going to really find a place to you know, settle down and write this book, Transformer Shamans of the 21st Century. And so the point is, though, that I realized that I probably would need to share this story a little bit more as the events, unfolded as they are now. And, you know, this weekend we had a warning from the Canadian geologist that said they've been monitoring events offshore on the seafloor, and that this week and maybe for the next 10 days or so, there's an increased risk of a major earthquake that, if it ruptured in its worst-case scenario, might generate as high as a, 8.5 to a 9.0 magnitude earthquake.
God.
And that would be catastrophic, and it has happened before, back in the 1700s. We are overdue, in fact, for a major megaquake off the British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, North California coast. I can tie this into interviews that I've had with folks who have had visionary experiences, like Daniel Brinkley, for example. He was shown that there would be a large earthquake, about an 8.5, 8.6, off the Mendocino Fault in Northern California. Now, could this be part of this sequence of events that Mount Rainier also may erupt, and that the Cascadia subduction zone, that's about 80 miles, give or take, off the coast of Washington, Oregon, mm-hmm. and as well as this warning from the Canadian geologist, could it be of a single piece of the puzzle? I believe it is. I think we're seeing the early warning indicators that we need to really pay attention. As I say, there's no need to panic, but we need preparation. Just as we saw the hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, etc., we need to realize, folks, that we're responsible for ourselves. The government can only do so much, and as we see, very little, it seems. Being a retired federal employee, that hurts me a little bit. But I understand that the task of FEMA is awesome. I mean, it's no matter, what we can say about, too little, too late, or not enough resources applied in the right areas, the task is overwhelming. We need to realize that we are responsible for ourselves, our families, our children, our grandchildren,
mm-hmm.
and we need to really take stock of what it might have been like for our ancestors to be pioneers that crossed the Great Divide, et cetera, and came west, for example, as my grandparents did from Wisconsin, and prior to that from New York, and prior to that Canada, and then Scotland, Denmark. So the point is that life has a certain built-in high risk factor to it, and so I take this as a challenge. And so those who do listen to our show tonight, I want them to realize that this is not a doom and gloom scenario. It's a be prepared and take stock of where you live and what the the natural disasters that may befall you can be, and be prepared.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. I mean, it happened again just in Florida a couple of days ago. We had all kinds of tornadoes in the middle of winter down there. My sister lives in West Palm Beach in Florida, and didn't really affect her, but, craziness down there.
Well, I wonder if she felt the earthquake, a 6.2 magnitude, just detonated off the off of Cuba.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I saw that today, too. We've had lots of big quakes in the last few years, and we've got comets flying by. This amazing comet McNaught that is sort of leaving our neck of the woods right now has accompanied all kinds of strange sort of Earth events.
Yes, of course, and the ancients and the shamans and such folks realized that, there was things going on around them that they took stock of, and they realized that they were cyclic, that when they saw them again, they realized that a certain amount of the same types of events would recur. And, like a classic for Missouri would be Mark Twain. He was born right on Halley's Comet and died on Halley's Comet.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
But the point is that, you can't live your life on all of these types of signs of the times unless you really put the big picture together, and I hope that's what I've done in my book.
Yeah, you actually have. I think you've done a great job, and it's called Transformers, Shamans of the 21st Century. It's written by John J. Harper. And, John, tell them a little bit about the website, maybe.
Well, again, it's at johnjharper.com, johnjayharper.com. But, again, the important thing, I believe, is to realize that there's a lot to the book, more than just doom and gloom, because there's none of that, really. I really, and I've said this for many years now, you know, we're being prepared to bloom. So, you know, this is what I believe is happening, is that as the energies from the sun increase and we have more intense solar flare activity, as David Hathaway, NASA just announced a couple weeks ago, that he sees that solar cycle 24, which we're just in the beginning of, that it's going to peak around 2011, 2012, and there's going to be perhaps solar flares more intense than any time in the 400-year history since Galileo looked through a filtered telescope at the sun.
Yep, and saw the sunspots for the first time.
Exactly.
You know, I'm sort of a sun bug, you know, John, and this guy I mentioned earlier, his name's Kent Stedman. He's the reason Kent and I are friends is because years ago, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, I hooked up with him in the early days of the internet because he was one of the few guys out there that was hooked up with the SOHO satellites and stuff many, many years ago, right?
Excellent.
And so I became friends with Kent, and anyway, anybody who's paying attention to the sun, I mean, I've watched now, literally myself, in other words, these are personal experiences that I've witnessed, not something that I've read, you know, not something that somebody told me, but, you know, real experiences that I've witnessed with my own eyes or whatever. And I've watched the entire last solar cycle. And, I mean, I've also read and looked at historical cycles, and I don't care what anybody's saying. Things are getting wild on the sun.
Yes, they are. And of course, it's interesting, isn't it, that, you know, the ancients, like the Mayans, the Aztecs, etc., they talk about, you know, world suns. They talk about the ages.
Yeah, the fifth sun, the sixth sun, the fourth
exactly,
sun.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Depending on, you know, which culture you investigate, they're always tying things into solar ages and to even sun gods. And you know, this idea runs through all of theology and religion, and we just kind of don't understand that, you know, that we're in a living organism called Gaia. The Greeks called Mother Earth Gaia,
mm-hmm.
and James Lovelock, you know, picked up on this word.
Right, years ago,
made it famous. But the point is that we need to you know, look up. You know, I mean, most of us are shuffling our feet and looking down at our shoelaces. We need to stand up erect, you know, like we were meant to be, and look up. And realize that sun, you know, is driving everything. That's what triggers all the, you know, the four seasons, the tilt of the Earth, and the way the sun hits the surface of the planet based on that angular tilt is what drives everything, including, you know, when seeds pop out of the ground and when the grass turns green again in many parts of our country in North America, and when folks go to sleep and when they wake up and when animals, you know, hibernate. I mean, how whales and porpoises, et cetera, migrate. You know, they're tracking biorhythms that are driven by the solar cycles, the sun, the day and night cycle. And so we need to really remember this, you know, now. This is critical because as the energies increase globally, we're going to see these earthquakes intensify. We're going to see tsunamis. We're going to see greater storms. It really doesn't matter to me about the debate about global warming, whether it's man-made or natural cycles. The point is you can stick your head out the window once in a while and see the changes, right?
Right, right.
And
right.
So I always say, I've been asked this question before. In fact, Art Bell on Coast to Coast asked me here a few days ago, you know, what, John, where are you on the global warming? You know, is it man-made or none at all, or is it 50-50? And I said, well, the one thing that I do know is that we've about polluted ourselves to death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the toxicity is part of this equation. If for no other reason, it's changing all of our relationship to the natural world because we've created such a septic tank system,
right.
You know, And the point is that the Earth is a living organism at the subatomic level, at the molecular level, at the cellular level. And if she wants to keep plants alive, animals alive, and us alive, without even bringing consciousness into this, I mean, I'm using this metaphorically now, and I'm saying that, you know, if Gaia wants to stay as a vibrant being, then there's got to be a purification or a detoxification cycle, and I would say that's what we're in big time. Mm.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because I have people ask me that the same thing all the time, and I'm not very popular here at the radio station, actually, because everybody here has like jumped on the Al Gore bandwagon and all this sort of thing, right? And I say, well, look, I mean, the one thing that I'll agree to is that, yes, the Earth appears to be in a state of flux and that everything seems to be shifting and changing. And the climate is certainly one of those things. Where I disagree, though, is that anybody really knows what the hell is going on. And that by extrapolation from that, that they can actually prescribe solutions, you know. I think that nobody knows what's going on, and when you really don't have clarity on, you know, all of the factors involved, then how could you possibly prescribe a solution, you know?
Well, let me shine a little bit of light from my perspective in terms of interviewing folks who've had near-death experiences, because I believe there are some folks, Mike, walking around the planet speaking very softly and carrying a big green stick, okay, talking about how to restore the Earth to a more vibrant state. And the story is very simple. Some of these folks were taken off planet during their near-death experience. And if we just, for sake of argument, just say, okay, well, maybe that's a possibility. Maybe you can come out of your body if information and consciousness is what we really are, then maybe the body is, you know, just, you know, the vehicle that carries that consciousness. And so if we just leave it at that for a moment and realize that some folks have come out of body and looked back on the Earth and saw where the energy was depleted, and what they realized was, and what they told me when I've interviewed them, is that there is a magnetic signature to everything, that every tree, every plant, every animal, every human is basically barcoded magnetically. There's a certain energy field that is there, and if it's in balance, then you have a vibrant ecosystem, a vibrant biosphere, a marvelous place to be. And when you start clear-cutting forests, and when you start gill-netting fishes out of the sea, when you start destroying crops with toxins, you're changing the magnetic signature of that particular piece of ground. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, you're inviting storms, rain, you know, abnormal rainfall, high winds, other natural events to come there and try to restore the magnetic field to that ground. And so if that's the case, let's look around at areas in the Northwest, for example. When I was a child here 50 years ago in the Northwest, I lived in a wonderland. I lived in a pristine environment. And in my home, in fact, was gravity-fed by water that came off the Olympic National Park area, off the Olympic Mountains. When I was in high school, I moved away from Mount Rainier, over across Puget Sound, over to the Olympic National Park area, a little town, Silverdale, that I mentioned earlier, and we didn't even purify our water, and that was back in the 60s. And so, you know, from that point, I mean, I wouldn't even dare taste the water that I found on the ground over there now, and because of the destruction of the environment.
John, I just wrote a note here, and I put a big circle around it, because every once in a while I get a shiver, you know. And
I'm with you on those.
Yeah. The key, and this is, I'm going to tell you exactly what I wrote down, was that the key is to restore balance to the place where you are.
I like it.
In other words, there's an amazing thing that happened on the 24th of January, and this is the reason why it's in my mind, is this guy died whose name was Peter Tompkins, and he wrote this book in 1969 or 1970 called The Secret Life of Plants.
Sure did.
Right?
Yep.
And he died just a couple of weeks ago, and I always like to recognize people that had an influence on me when they pass away, but Anyway, Peter Tompkins was amazing. And one of the things that he relates in one of his books is how a person, I forget exactly who the name of the person in the book, but anyway, this person was a plant person, a person of, a green person, a person of nature, and was living in California and had a greenhouse outside and basically made a living and a life with plants. And there was one of the biggest earthquakes that happened in the earlier part of the second half of the century, and there was a tremendous amount of devastation in the exact area where this man lived. And guess what? Everything around him was devastated, but his greenhouse and his place stood.
Yeah, I don't think that's a coincidence. I really believe there's something to this. And, you know, again, I just use one example, but I have others in my book, but along these lines. But I'm firmly convinced, as a former electronics engineer and someone who's dabbled in this type of information for so many years now, I'm convinced that that's what we're talking about, and that human beings themselves are a huge electromagnet. You know, we walk into a room and with a group of people, and we say, "Whoa, this has got some bad vibes to it," you know, or "It's got some great energy to it," you know. We need to realize that we're as electromagnetic as an engine or technology, and that we're just mirror images of the way the natural order of the world works. And look at our machines. I mean, our medical technology, we have, electroencephalograms and electrocardiograms, right, electromyograms. Okay, we're measuring energy all the time. Well, folks, for Pete's sake, look at what's around us. I mean, the impact we have on plants and animals, the air, the water, The other big thing, that really hit me and I share in my book is about DNA. And, I got to give credit to folks like Terrence McKenna and Dennis and others, Bruce Lipton and Dr. Jeremy Narby.
Jeremy Narby.
Isn't that great stuff? The cosmic amazing serpent, DNA, and the origins of knowledge.
Right. He's been on the program before. Jeremy's great. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we're, Mike, we're coming full circle again to realizing what the Egyptians and the Mayans did, and that is that the sun is driving the earth system, the earth engines. And when we shift this solar energy around, this green energy that comes through photosynthesis and plant life, and, the animals eat the plants, and we eat the animals and the plants, what we're really going after is solar energy in our food.
Amazing.
And when we degrade that, we change the magnetic signature on everything, and these sunspot cycles come back every 11 years to kind of, it's kind of a booster shot. Right? And then every 11 years, on a 22-year cycle of sunspots, the sun will flip its fields. Well, now you hear folks talk about pole shift, and I'm talking not geophysical, I'm talking electromagnetic pole shift. We're way overdue for that shift. And what is that all about? Well, it's going to renew the entire planet and shift the energies around and restore balance.
All right. Look, John, it's top of the hour. Let's take a little break, all right?
Great.
All right, everybody. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Check out my guest on the web, johnjharper.com, J-O-H-N-J-A-Y, harper.com. Amazing stuff, a wonderful book he's written. It's called Transformers, Shamans of the 21st Century. We'll come back and talk more with John in just a couple of minutes here. I got another piece of music here from my friends, The Feed. This one is about money and Las Vegas. But this ain't no gambling bet here on this radio station, so call us and give us some of your hard-earned money. It's Pledge Drive Week. It's Mike, and I need your help. On the web, kopn.org. It's very easy to donate and to become a member of the station and to become a faithful supporter and a proud supporter, one that doesn't have to hide his face when he sees me in the supermarket of KOPN and Radio Orbit, all right? Just do it on the web at kopn.org. Find a way to donate and help us out. It's community radio, free speech at its best, and a place where you get to hear people like John J. Harper and also amazing independent music like Elise Brion, who's still hanging with me here in the studio and enjoying the show tonight, and also music like this. Yeah, The Feed. I love it. Brother, You're So Cold. That's brand new music. I think it's probably the first time it's been heard on the radio, as a matter of fact. Exclusive stuff that the guy sent me. Thank you, Dave, by the way. Just a couple days. And you can check out The Feed on the web at, I guess the best way is just go to their MySpace page, probably. You know, it's funny, a month ago, you wouldn't have heard me say MySpace on the program because, you know, I was ignorant, frankly. MySpace is like anything else. It can be wonderful or it can be really silly. You know, there are lots and lots of people that are using this to communicate and network and to share their art and their music and lots of other things. And this is how I came across The Feed. So here's to MySpace. And it's also the way I came across Paul Laffoley, who's going to be on the program next week, who's just going to blow everybody's minds. You know, Paul Laffoley will tell you how to build a time machine. Actually says he's got a diagram to do it, and he actually will show it to us. It's art, essentially. But anyway, I digress. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's Pledge Drive Week. I have John J. Harper on the line with me. I'm not going to make him wait any longer. But please, get on your computer, go to the Internet, and visit kopn.org. And please help us out. Donate a little bit of money and keep Radio Orbit and KOPN strong in central Missouri and now around the world. John J. Harper. Hey, John, thanks for sticking around.
My pleasure, Mike.
John, let's talk about the butterfly effect.
Yes. Well, you know, that term is used in different capacities, but, you know, it became kind of the battle cry for the weather folks years ago when Dr. Lorenz came up with this idea of chaos driving weather systems. And, you know, he used different metaphors, and it became kind of a logo for them in terms of, we've heard this idea that, you know, if there's a, say, a storm in the Sea of Japan, that, you know, the next day maybe a tornado will touch down in Topeka, Kansas.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, and the butterfly effect is this idea that, you know, there's feedback loops, and that like a caterpillar evolves and through the chrysalis into a butterfly, that, you know, we can start looking at organic processes in the same way that, you know, they start out in kind of a seed form, and then they blossom into a flower form and a fruit form. And so I think that might be a very relevant way of looking at what's going on today. We're seeing all kinds of things that look ugly, and they look kind of messy and gooey, but yet there's something maybe that some wings are going to sprout on some of these things and really turn into something as beautiful as a monarch butterfly. So, you know, that's kind of a quick overview of what I see happening.
Do you think this is happening to us?
Yeah, I do. I honestly think that there's some good research that, Colin Kelleher, Dr. Kelleher, who wrote some marvelous papers about 5 years ago or so.
He's with NIDS, right?
Yeah, this National Institute of Discovery Science outfit that I think was run by Robert Bigelow, who's an aerospace.
Right, Bob Bigelow, yeah.
Yeah, and
man, he did a lot of great stuff, and still is.
They're still doing great stuff. I think NIDS has kind of been put on the simmer, but you know, I'm sure there's a lot of great science going on in the background with all these folks that were part of that group. But you know, in answering a little bit more of your intent there, there's some research that shows that there's a way to take DNA and basically go back and tap what we call the junk DNA. 97% of the DNA sequences are really not needed to create a human form. So maybe 3% is used in that capacity to build proteins and you know, turn that into structure, tissue, cells, organ systems, etc. So what is that 97% junk DNA that's not being used? Well, a lot of it, of course, is the evolutionary family tree that we participate in, that have the entire plant and animal kingdom, you know, sequences, and we carry that in our DNA. I mean, we are literally books of life, if you will. I mean, we are this entire planet's history of all living forms, from the oceans on to dry ground and to the tops of trees and back down again, if you believe that model of reality. But I'm not a Darwinian, so I don't. Mm-hmm. But I believe more like Michael Cremo, who wrote books like Forbidden Archaeology.
Right, amazing book, Forbidden.
And Human Devolution.
Right.
Right. And so basically we're angels that fell into some type of evolutionary spiral that took us to the earth, and then we're now evolving back towards that angelic state of light and consciousness and being that I believe is where we're going. And you know, that's again what I write about pretty extensively in my book.
John, you talk about junk DNA and the idea that the general idea in science is that it's just sort of worthless or just some sort of a mistake or something. And to me, that seems so opposite of what nature really does. And I think of this, there was this great old scientific philosopher, his name was P.W. Bridgman, and he talked about coincidence. And he said a coincidence is something that occurs after you apply a bad theory.
I love it.
Right? And that's that's the whole junk DNA thing. I think, there's no such thing as junk DNA. We just don't know what it's for yet.
That's right. I agree with you. And I think that, you know, anyone that really can get to the level of molecular biology and get to that level, I think most of us walk away with a spiritual idea, as Dr. Bruce Lipton did. I mean, it dawned on him that what's really going on is that information is being uploaded and downloaded from a greater field of consciousness, and that when we see something physical, well, the form of it, you know, was encapsulated in a software program and was downloaded through into the hardware, you know, and so we're the hardware, and we're basically looking back, reflecting back on the software, trying to see what the sequence of events is that created us physically. And so it's kind of, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Well, it seems like both coexist simultaneously.
That seems to be the theme, right?
Yeah, it is. It's like a mirror image that you can't have one without the other. And so it takes two to tango. Well, it's probably the same thing, you know, in terms of biology and chemistry and physics, that there needs to be a mirror and then a reflected image for it to make sense at all, for one to exist, the other has to exist. The shadow, you might say, has to always be part of the physical manifestation of the object. So, you know, this is like holograph. Hologram means hollow, from Greek means whole, and gram means message. So a hologram is a whole image. And when I saw my deceased friend George DeGay, I realized that he was in a crystalline form that was holographic, but what it was pure information that really created that image for me. In other words, I'm sure I didn't get the opportunity to, but I'm sure I could have waved my hand through that image, yet it was as vibrant and alive and real as anything that, you know, I see on a normal day.
All right, well, you talk about image, you talk about mirrors, holographs. We need to talk about light. All these things are representations in some form of light. Let's talk about light.
Yeah, well, light is where everything seems to originate. That, you know, whether we're talking in physics, when we go to laser technology now, or projecting holographic images, or whether you're talking spiritually about, you know, in the beginning God said, let there be light, there seems to be this common theme to creation in the laboratory or in the world itself, that light, again, we're talking about the sun, you know, we're talking about solar energy, we're talking about information that crystallizes into some type of molecular lattice form that actually we can touch and taste and feel and experience. So when we see an object, what we're really seeing is a crystallization of light itself, of photons, of solar energy. And so this is really not, something that is all that metaphysical when you get down to it. When you really understand that everything's kind of layer upon layer of light energy, and that especially the way crystals work. If you start playing with crystals and mirrors and that kind of stuff, rocks that have those that property, you start seeing that everything is very symmetrical. Everything kind of light bounces off of these crystals in a way that kind of self-replicates. It kind of just keeps on keeping on, and especially in the laboratory setting when you get pure crystals. Just think of a minute about radio, the early days of radio. Mm. When I was a kid, I used to play with a crystal radio.
Right, me too, yeah.
I had this rock, it was called Galena, and you used to just take like a safety pin and just kind of just, you know, literally kind of tap on that rock and create what they call a piezoelectric effect, which is a spark. And that spark would then, you know, be translated and conditioned a little bit through a real simple little electrical circuit. And you, that was the beginning of radio, you know, and being able to take a voice, the human voice, and replicate it through long distances. And, you know, the telegraph and then the, telecommunications industry kicked off. But the point is that, you know, even today we have system clocks in our computers and our calibrated clocks that we have with the National Bureau of Standards in Colorado. Those are all based on this crystal idea that you can replicate a pure frequency, and it's very consistent over time. And, again, you can tie all that back to perhaps how we're created and the world itself, and it just becomes a gigantic hologram in the end. It becomes Edgar Mitchell, you know, talks about the holographic universe, and others like Michael Talbot made that book famous.
Right. What about Schopenhauer? There's a great quote that you put in your book. I forget what it is, but it talks about this, the dream and the dreamer, everyone dreaming.
Yeah. Well, that's an ancient idea of really, we ought to give credit where credit's due, which is goes back to the Australian Aborigines, you know, in the universal dream time.
Mm.
And that we come from this great sacred space that I would call today in physics the zero-point field. And the zero-point field, real simply, is when you get down to the basic ground state of energy, it should just basically go away, that there should be no vibration. And yet when we get down to absolute 0 degrees, which is around 470-some degrees Fahrenheit, 250 or so centigrade, you get to a state where you still have a little bit of vibration going on, this residual, a lot of engineers, we tried to actually get rid of it. It's called noise, static. Well, it seems to be the case that is really the purest state of information, and I believe consciousness itself is the zero-point field. And that's in a vacuum. That's at absolute zero. It's real cold. I mean, it's so incredibly cold there that everything forms a pure crystal at that level. And so that's when you get things like, you get magic there, Mike. You get superconductivity. And you get things that just don't go away. I mean, they just self-replicate. And I'm sure, in my opinion, these are some of the things that Terrence McKenna would have, said today, had he used these particular metaphors, and realized that, you know, this, he talked about these fluids and this kind of a mental silly putty that he came across,
this
shamanic idea of taking a substance and forming it into anything that you wanted to through consciousness.
Right, essentially the stone, the philosopher's stone.
The philosopher's stone, the elixir, right. Mm-hmm. Exactly, and so again, stone, and we're talking about rocks, and we're talking about crystals.
Right.
Exactly. There's something there, in other words.
You know, this is between you and me, right?
Right.
It's whoever's listening, but it's 1:20 in the a.m., and I think about Terrence a lot because he was a friend of mine, you know, and I knew him as not a book writer, although I've read everything he ever wrote, you know, but I also knew him as just the guy that was just talking, you know, like you sit around and talk to your friend, you know.
Yeah.
And I know Dennis, and I tell you what, this is not silly putty, you know. What Terrence saw was the real deal, and whether his interpretation was exactly correct or not is I think it's sort of going to be a side note, but I'm telling you, man,
These guys are all over it. And, you know, back in the day when they wrote Invisible Landscape in 1972, there was talk of electron tunneling in that book and quantum states of this and that and all kinds of silliness that most people laughed at. Now this stuff is just common. And again, like you say, it's been 100 years since these ideas were originally developed, but they caught on way before anybody else was willing to accept this, and I think Terrence really had a feel for what was coming.
Oh, I'm absolutely convinced of it as well. I don't find any other conclusion to be rational if you really look at what he did with the knowledge and how he broke it apart and teased the essence out of it and then tried to put it back together in a scientific framework that still, in my opinion, holds water. He basically went in and used his consciousness, his mind, through an altered state of consciousness to tap the zero-point field and actually look through the lens of his DNA and realize that he was that, that this is part, you know, one of the things I learned from my experience with my deceased friend mm-hmm. was that he was never deceased, number one, and number two, that the DNA itself is a liquid crystal, and, you know, this has been proven now in the laboratory, and we know this, there's books written on this topic, and papers and articles now, but, you know, back then, when Terrence was doing, like you say, this was all just, you know, this was really woo-woo science.
Right, right.
And, you know, he had to go to the jungle, for Pete's sake, to even, you know, get a handle on it.
Right.
And then still
realize that there was no handle.
Yeah, exactly. Then to lose the grip on reality was mandatory. And then it boils down to basically this, that dimethyltryptamine, or DMT, which is, you know, an endogenous substance made in our brain and our lungs and our blood.
Mm-hmm.
And so this molecule, as Dr. Rick Strassman, MD, psychiatrist, has said in his book on the same title, DMT, the Spirit Molecule, that, you know, what we're looking at, it seems to be the case, is the lens by which, you know, our consciousness hitchhikes on throughout the cosmos. And I just don't see any other conclusion but to, you know, understand that we're immortal, that, you know, we just, you know, you just can't kill us, you know.
You know, you mentioned Joseph Campbell before, and he had this. He had so many great things that he said, but I remember one of the bits from The Power of Myth, and he said, "Am I the bulb, or am I the light, of which the bulb is just a vehicle?"
Yes, and I remember when he was sitting there in that library with Bill Moyers, he was saying, you know, in essence, he said, "We don't even understand the energy that's driving the bulb, you know."
Right.
I mean, how can, and this is what gets back to what Jeremy Narby was saying.
Oh, yeah, I wanted
you know,
to talk
about
more
DNA
about Narby,
because
yeah.
He's saying, you know, basically that, you know, how in the world could we say that DNA is not minded, is not conscious, if it's the everything that creates the physical world around us, the animals, the plants, it's in the water, it's in the air, it's in space.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, people don't realize that when you fully understand DNA, it's not just biological stuff. You can make pop cans and microphones.
That's it, exactly.
You can do everything with DNA.
Exactly, because, you know, now we're talking nanotechnology.
Right, that's basically what it is, yeah.
Yeah, and so, in other words, when we boil everything down to its essence, what it is alive.
right, it's an animistic look at things, absolutely.
Yeah, and so maybe there is nothing beyond DNA. Maybe there's nothing beyond that crystal, that liquid crystal, because everything that needs to manifest is contained within it. And so everything is just a reconfiguration, a mutation, if you will, of this living mind of God that perhaps is DNA itself.
Holy cow.
You know, Dr. Fritz Popp, you know, in Germany, who, you know, Jeremy Narby made a point of calling Dr. Popp in his laboratory in Germany and saying, you know, Professor, Herr Professor, what do you think consciousness is? You know, and after, I'm sure, a couple hiccups, you know, Dr. Popp said, well, you You know, I could almost hear that German accent. You know, I'm sure he said something like, well, you know, Jeremy, it's probably the electronic emissions from the DNA itself. It's the field, you know.
Wow.
So, and I think that's probably it. I mean, that's the same conclusion. And remember, we're talking about what comes first, the chicken or the egg. What comes first, the DNA or the field of consciousness? Well, I think they're mirror images of each other, and it's just a teasing out of something that is just, you know, you just can't break it down any further.
Right, and again, you know, one of the things that I want to talk about Narvi again really quickly, but I also want to add that and sort of close out with Terrence, that he was always really keen on talking about how there was no closure. And the idea that we're always looking for that final closure, you know, the chicken or the egg.
Right.
It's not going to happen. It is both and at the same time, just as you point out. Now, Narvi also mentions in his book about DNA and light, and about how essentially at the core of DNA is a photonic vibration of light.
That's right, he calls it biophotons.
Right. Holy cow. Talk about that for just a few minutes before we go to break, about the significance of that, John.
Well, you know, what we're really getting down to is this idea that really, you know, almost drives us insane. I mean, we want to be able to name it and claim it and then, you know, patent it and then market it, okay, in our society especially, right?
Right.
And so we keep thinking that we can break everything down to its basic element. And all we're doing is creating new elements. I mean, you know, this is just like massive silly putty that we just cannot get off our hands, you know. It's just we keep trying to move it and shake it and remold it. And all it does is just morphs. It goes off into new forms, and we just can't get our mind around that yet, that we are trapped by consciousness. We're in this huge net, you know, and all we're doing, we keep struggling with science and religion. We keep struggling to name it and claim it and patent it and, you know, make it our own. And, you know, we want to own God, in other words. We want to, you know, God is this way and no other way. And you know, science, the laws of nature are this way and they're no other way. This is just not what is happening. This is not our observations are saying this is not the case. And we refuse to accept this because, you know, it's essentially game over. You know, take a deep breath and relax. You know, look around and see that, you know, the mess we've created. See, we're not wanting to now own up to the mess we've created by struggling against nature. And so when we say, you know, we don't want to accept that there's nothing else out there, that we're it, you know, the consciousness is it.
What we're saying is
that we just have not really wrestled this thing to the ground yet at some level. And again, to make this relevant to all the things we've talked about in the last hour and a half, we really got to realize that we're co-creating reality as we go. And this, what I think, is the message of 2012. When we talk about the end of time, we're talking about the end of time and space as we know it. And so what we're really doing now is we're seeing sense turning into nonsense. Because we're at the end of the road. We're starting to understand that we are the co-creators of reality and that we have to take self-responsibility or we're going to self-destruct.
Right. All right. Well, with that lovely note, we'll take a break, all right? All right, John, thanks. We'll come back in just a minute, okay?
Great.
All right, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Don't forget. Even though it's 1:30 in the a.m., it is pledge drive week, and I would certainly appreciate it if you appreciate this program. You hop on the web, go to kopn.org, and figure out the way to manage or navigate over to the donation section and pledge a little bit of your hard-earned money to us and the station and keep community radio alive and well in mid-Missouri and now across the nation and the world, streaming tonight live for the first time officially on KOPN. Of course, I've been streaming the show since last May, thanks to my great friends over at Cosmic Waves Radio, and we're, of course, still streaming there, and we'll continue to. So you can catch my show on either now the KOPN stream or the Cosmic Wave stream. But regardless, KOPN, a great stride for the radio station because now the KOPN stream is 24/7. And it's a great, for you guys out there listening to my show on the web, grab the link for the KOPN stream because, when you're at work or wherever, check out KOPN during the day or wherever. When I don't have to be on the air. There's lots of great shows and great music being presented and great entertainment, good news on KOPN. So, I encourage you all to check out KOPN regardless of whether you're here in Missouri or not. It's a total island, total oasis here in the middle of Missouri. But, man, this place is awesome. And KOPN does a great job, and the people that are associated with it are doing wonderful work. And if you're in the community and supporting the station, I really appreciate it. And if you're not, well, I hope that you decide to, okay? Here's another song from The Feed, my new friends from St. Louis, Missouri. And back in just a minute, okay, with John J. Harper on the web, johnjharper.com. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. Back in just a few. Yeah, more great music from The Feed. I think that song is called Chicago. The reason that I don't know is because it's written on the CD itself, and the CD's in the player. And the reason it's written on the CD is because it's a brand new song that nobody's ever heard before. And thank you to Dave and the guys from The Feed for letting me play that tonight for the Radio Orbit crowd. Great, great new music from St. Louis, The Feed. Check them out on the web. I'll make sure I link over to their site. But I know you can get to them at myspace.com/TheFeed. And I think there's another one called Feed Rock. Where's their... I'm not going to make a mistake. I'm actually going to grab the cover here and make sure I'm not screwing up, even though that's not it. All right, let's see. What's it say here? There it is. I was right, you see. On the web, www.thefeedband.com and myspace.com/feedrock. Okay? Excellent stuff. Thanks, guys. We'll play more of it down the road, okay? Also, pledge drive, kopn.org. As my son says. All right, I'll do it one more time. If you haven't heard it yet, this is my son, Alistair. He's 3 years old, and he is a friend of KOPN.
You're listening to Radio Orbit on the air. KOPN, Columbia, Missouri, 89.5 FM. Fun drive. Give us some money. We need some money. Please, help us. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you know, I gotta love it. Anyway, he speaks it like it is. Give us some money. We need your money. Please help us. Okay. Anyway, back to business here. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. It's about 1:40 a.m. on now the 6th of February, 2007. Okay, I've got John J. Harper. And thanks so much, John, for sticking with us here late into the night. He's in, not far from Tacoma, I guess, Washington. And, not Tacoma. Where the hell are you at, John?
I'm at Spokane, about 240 miles due east of Seattle.
All right. Gosh, all right. So you're pretty much inland then.
I'm hoping I'm as far as I need to be. Given the early part of our conversation,
oh, man,
and what
I
share in my book about Earth changes. But I think that the foremost thing on my mind right now is how much royalty is your son getting for this commercial?
Nothing yet, you know.
Well, see, I've got 8 grandkids. So, you know, just to bring this right to ground, I mean, you know, the reason I stay up these late nights and I chit-chat with good folks like yourself and your wise audience is so that we can have some type of awareness should things really, get out of hand here pretty soon. We need to, I think, have some kind of handle on why is it happening and realize that if we keep hanging on, things are going to get better. They're not going to get worse. But we're going to go through a few speed bumps, and a lot of folks are not going to be able to keep their balance. And, one of the things we haven't touched upon yet is that when I retired from the Department of Defense, I had transitioned from an engineer to a mental health counselor, and I actually worked with the U.S. Navy Hospital Clinic at Keyport, Washington, and I was kind of the program director working with military and civilians that were in crises. And so what that means, though, is that I have sensed that the biggest part of my latter life will be trying to help folks keep their balance. And, I think this is what we're seeing at every level of society. The wheels are kind of falling off the axles just about everywhere I look, at least, in social services and health care and education. I mean, the kids are really, coming on strong now. There's a lot of energies surfacing where teachers and administrators don't really know how to structure the curriculum to handle all the kids that are having problems. And, you know, we've got a tremendous alcohol, drug, and other problem. And this is understandable from my perspective because we're trying to self-medicate these energies. And we're trying to deal with the stress and strain of a society that's really about ready to burst at the seams. So we got all this other thing going on. We got weather changes. We got, solar events. And, I mean, we got to realize that we are these energies and that There's no guilt here. There ain't no guilt trip to go on. There's no blame game to be played. We need to pull together as a human species, and we need to share with one another from the heart more about, you know, what we're experiencing. And we don't need to, you know, lash out. We need to turn within mm-hmm. more and more and sense that this has a purpose. I think I can boil everything I'm about down to this idea that, you know, we're really getting ready for a transformation at the cellular level. And this, and folks that have had near-death experiences, I think, and shamans and mystics like Gopi Krishna and others, you know, folks that I've actually had the privilege of talking to over the years, people who have been clinically dead for, say, 90 minutes and been revived, who have profound insights to not only global changes, but how the human being is going to be transformed through crises. And, you know, one of the things that I share at my website, so if nobody else does anything else, I hope they'll swing by at some point in time and download that free report on the bird flu, because as I've shared with millions of people over the last several years, that I see pandemics such as bird flu becoming more catastrophic than all the earth changes combined. The millions of people, in other words, we might lose to natural disasters in the next 5 to 10 years, I think will be just overshadowed by the number of people that we lose to things such as pandemics of flu.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not a good thing to think about, but I have to state it as it is. My grandfather was a Seattle police officer during the great flu pandemic of 1918 at the end of World War One, and I have an aunt that is nearly 90 years old in Seattle who shared with me just recently, just a few weeks ago, the fact that my grandfather, her father, actually had to take the paddy wagon. He was a jailer for the Seattle Police Department back in, you know, the old Keystone Cop days. And he had to take that paddy wagon and turn it into an ambulance, and he literally picked the bodies off the streets of Seattle that fell from the flu. And he never got the flu. And my aunt, who again is almost 90 years old, has never had the flu a day in her life. And her physician, years and years ago, was doing blood work on her and found out she had some tremendous immunities. And she said, did your parents ever, how did they do through that flu pandemic? And she shared the story that my grandfather shared with her, that he never got the flu, even though he was exposed to it. So, you know, the flip side of this, I mean, there's this sense of doom, I guess, in some circles. But, you know, the flu pandemic, which when it comes, will come in three phases. And if you'll let me talk just a minute to this, I'd like to share some good information.
Please.
With your listeners. You know, the flu pandemic will come probably in the spring of a year. This bird flu will probably, it's only two mutations away now from becoming transmissible by humans to humans. And you can think of this as a key and a lock. And we have these couple proteins left that have been identified. Those are the locks, and the keys will be that protein synthesis that turns this chain of events, these molecules on, that allows them to be easily conveyed through a sneeze or a cough or a touch. And so the locks and the keys are there, but the key hasn't been inserted in these two locks or turned yet. So we might be a few weeks or a few months or even a year or two away, but I'm very concerned that this probably will evolve into a pandemic, a worldwide disaster, and it'll come in three ways. It'll start in the spring. Phase one is when folks will get the flu, and 100% of us basically will be exposed to it within a matter of weeks worldwide. This is through air travel and just the atmosphere itself. The jet stream will carry these molecules, these viruses. And the point is, though, that that's not the biggie. The biggie is always in phase two, and that'll come about 6 months or so after phase one. That'll be the killer phase, when those of us who go down are going to go down then. Then there's a kind of a mop-up phase, which will come the following spring. And the point is, too, that the most impacted population from a viral flu pandemic will not be so much the children and the elderly, although they're going to be a huge part of that population is going to suffer fatality. It's actually the young college-age folks that always go down during these pandemics, about age 20 to 30, give or take. That's quite a shock when people understand that. And so the necessity, of course, to, you know, isolate oneself from the infection is the key, you know, to, as the government's saying. I mean, you know, there's a lot of good stuff out there now from the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, and I'm sure they're, I don't know how close you are to the University of Missouri campus, but...
pretty close.
Pretty close, and I would say that your health department folks there are right on top of this. My wife, Connie, works for Spokane Community College System and the Head Start program, you know, the preschool kind of kids, and, you know, she's saying that they're getting some very good information now along the lines I'm sharing. But I've been doing this for a few years now, and, you know, it was kind of an alarmist kind of thing 3-4 years ago, but I've been keeping on, because I sense that, you know, because I do have a certain amount of psychic sensitivity to what's coming, as, again, I share in my book these visions and things, and one of them that startled me the most was when I realized that this bird flu pandemic was going to manifest. And that's what really got me to rush my book to completion and, you know, get it out into the mainstream. So, I don't want to bring the program down on this note, but I really hope folks that listen to this and the replay of this will understand that this is some serious stuff coming our way.
Yeah, no doubt. I agree with you. I certainly do. I also think that, like your grandfather points out, though, that there is at least an aspect of this that has to do with the idea of just, and I guess you allude to it. In other words, make yourself safe, right?
Right.
Find a way to make yourself safe, whether
that's... Absolutely, and the key, I think, is to isolate us. You know, I know that the mainstream ideas out here that I've seen in the literature, both in Spokane community, and I'm sure it's handed down not only at the state level, but at the federal level, is, you know, we're going to have to close our schools, we're going to have to close our universities, we're going to have to isolate every aspect, shopping, theaters. There were some things on the internet here just last week and this weekend when they had this huge confirmation of the bird flu virus in England,
mm-hmm.
and where they've, you know, they've just killed 160,000 turkeys trying to stop the infection among the birds. But, you know, the point here is that 100% of us will be exposed to the virus in a 4 to 6 week period. Only 50% of us will ever get any symptoms, and the worst case is 25% of that particular age group that is infected would suffer a fatality. So it is bad, and that's the worst case. I don't see the worst case happening, because I believe that, you know, some of that junk DNA is going to rise to the surface and say, you know, I recognize that virus from my bloodline. You know, like in my case, my grandfather was exposed, did not get it. I have a living aunt that, you know, has never had the flu. That doesn't mean I might be the first to drop dead when it comes this time. You know, maybe my time is up.
Right.
But the point is that, you know, you need to do what you can. And there's certain things you can do to boost your immune system. I'm a real big guy on taking supplements that work, like Linus Pauling's research,
sure,
with vitamin C, right?
You know? Sure, yeah.
And I think that's important, mm-hmm. and I take things like flaxseed oil, which is an antiviral, antibacterial. There's all kinds of things you can do. And, you know, there's some literature out there that says elderberry extract is better than Tamiflu.
I've got people on the web that are commenting. I've got a girl here in the studio who's commenting about plants and herbs, and people talking about medicinal mushrooms and all kinds of things. And certainly I think this is part of the deal, John. I think it's that we got to get smart, you know?
Yeah, that's it. And share information like we're doing, you know?
Right.
And let folks really... I think that when things, you know, when the pressure builds to a point...
Huh.
where we really see these things manifesting, it's going to be really miraculous to see the benefit of email, the benefit of the internet.
Oh, man, oh, man.
The benefit of shows like you're doing, you know?
You know something? It's amazing, and it's a reasonable time to say this. Hey, by the way, will you stick around for a little while, maybe?
I can do a little bit.
Maybe 15 or 20 minutes even, not a whole long, but just maybe after the top of the hour to stick around.
Let's try to do that.
All right, because there's no one coming in here at 2. Normally I finish at 2, but there's no one coming in, and I've got a bunch of questions, and I thought maybe we could just stick around for a few more minutes.
Let's try to do that. I've got a pretty hectic schedule in the morning, but I'll try to do a few minutes.
All right, yeah, and whenever you're ready, just tell me.
Okay, and I've
appreciated all of your time up to this point, okay?
Not a problem.
Let's see here. Now where the hell am I? Let's talk about the psyche involved in this whole thing, too. I wanted to talk about weather and the psyche, but since we're talking about health, I guess they're sort of the same thing. Let's talk about weather and the psyche and health and the psyche.
Yeah, let's throw this little tidbit out. There is some scientific data. Highly controversial, but I think it's going to prove to be of relevance that flu pandemics are triggered by or correlated in some way with sunspot cycles.
Hmm.
And there it is,
the sun again, huh?
Yeah, there's the sun again, and I have looked into this, and I'm very concerned about the patterns that I see, and the fact that, you know, this is not distributed in the mainstream, I think, is because we have not got a handle on these cycles yet. I mean, we talk about ice age cycles, and we talk about weather cycles, and we talk about, you know, moon phases, and et cetera, et cetera. We have lost the ancient wisdom of what it means to be at the center of an integrated energy network that we call the Earth and the solar system and the Milky Way galaxy. And what we are probably going to be confronted with is the harsh reality that we have destroyed so much of our ecosystem and our biosphere unknowingly, what the impact would be on us, that we're going to suffer the consequences, and those are not going to be something that we would wish even on our enemies, because it's going to involve all of us. And again, I see the self-corrective mechanisms that are in place with the Earth, with the Sun, and with the Milky Way are going to have to be reconciled pretty quickly in order for us to take preventative measures. And I guess that's the bottom line on the last couple of hours, is that I've tried to take the key indicators and the major milestone and the talking points of everything that we've talked about for 2 hours and put into my book. Mainly not so much to say, hey, gosh, you know, look at how smart I am. It's more like, boy, I'm really concerned about everything that I've discovered. And it all came from a startling revelation that my colleague, who was a brilliant physicist, wasn't dead. And so, you know, I come back to this. I go, you know, what was that all about? And why am I involved in that process? And I think it's because I was someone that could put the pieces of the cosmic puzzle together quick enough, get it out into the mainstream so folks could start chatting about this. And the real proof of the pudding will be, can we use the information to create a preventative lifestyle, if you will, that will get more and more of us to survive what's coming?
Man, John, while we still have a few more minutes, I want to talk about the psychedelics then for a second, because I think that's a big part of this puzzle too, on a number of levels. Not on one level, getting a look, maybe, you know, a look ahead at what might be coming. But on the other hand, also maybe getting a leg up on how to handle it as it comes.
Well, here's the thing that will really tie all of this together. You know, Rick Strassman, MD, the psychiatrist who did this work at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine on dimethyltryptamine, has said recently, I don't know if you're aware of this, but, you know, he was very cautious, a very good scientist, very methodical, is a very methodical person, not given to more fantasy, it looks like, than he needs to. But he said recently, and I think Jeff Stray, in his book Beyond 2012, Catastrophe or Ecstasy, I believe is the subtitle.
That's right. You know, both those guys have been on the show.
Oh, cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if he said this in public, but I saw it, you know, in writing, and I've heard him do an interview or something that hinted at it, that, you know, Dr. Strassman is of the opinion that 2012 might be something as radical as a virus, you know, mutating through the human species and triggering a DMT release in the pineal gland that opens up our, you know, visionary, mystical state of consciousness, which
right.
I have suggested in my book. You know, and I tell you, I was floored. Now, I was not ready for Dr. Strassman to come up with that recently because I struggled with that, and I said that it has to be some type of mechanism like that, that if this is going to really happen, it's going to have to mutate and change DNA sequencing, protein synthesis, et cetera, in a way that only a virus could do. You know, think of a computer virus, you know, how rapidly it can replicate, self-replicate.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
That's what I'm talking about, is that it's going to have to infect, if you will, every one of us or the vast majority of us very quickly in order for it to stay in its same form, or it too would mutate and would not get the job done. So something's going to have to happen very quickly at some point, some critical point in time. And you know, 2012 is as good as any. And the other thing that Dr. Strassman touched on, he said, you know, it might be a solar flare that does this. Isn't that interesting?
Wow, and that came from Rick. That's amazing.
Yeah.
He's been very subtle, but also just absolutely revelatory, you know?
Oh, yeah. You know, these brilliant folks like this, sort of like Bruce Lipton and Rick Strassman and Terrence and Dennis McKenna's and the guys that, and gals that have enough of the science, and then they have the personal observation experiences to go with it.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's where you get the power, you know, the power kicks in when, you know, information is, and knowledge is power. And when it's integrated like that with science and spirit, boy, that to me is when I sit up and take notice.
Man, oh man, you aren't kidding. All right, one last question for you, okay?
You bet.
And where did I write it down here? Well, I guess, and it's sort of related to what we're talking about. I had, you know, we were talking about radio, the whole night we've been talking about radio and radios and crystals and all this stuff, right?
Sure.
Now we're talking about psychedelics and things like DMT and psilocybin. And when I was a kid, my dad gave me a radio. And one of the first things I did was, my dad loved radio, you know. And it's interesting that I love to do radio now. But anyway, my dad gave me a little portable, you know, one of those little old handheld radios, you know.
Sure.
And the first thing I did was took it apart to try to get at the little people inside it. You know?
Yeah, find out where that voice is coming from.
Right. And so I thought about that, you know, it really boggled me. And eventually I realized that, oh, the people weren't in there. They were somewhere else in a studio like I'm in right now. But what the radio was doing was somehow picking up on the wave that was coming from that radio station. And not only that, there were a whole bunch of different ones, and if you change the dial on the radio, you could pick up different ones. And so I realized that a couple of things. First of all, there were all kinds of waves going around, and you weren't always aware of them, right?
Sure.
And then the second thing was, if you had the right sort of mechanism, you could tune in to any particular one of them.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sure you're probably going right down the center lane of this idea.
And this is the DMT psilocybin thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly, and the fact that we are the field.
Oh, man.
You know, Albert Einstein said there is no physical matter. It's all the field.
Hmm.
And the field is information, is ideas, and crystallized into a physical form. And the overriding reality is that we are not form, we're the field, and that the field is immortal, and that we are it. Our thoughts and our feelings are field phenomenon, and this is Bruce Lipton's stuff too, and this is anybody that digs deep enough, long enough into physical matter, you realize it's all metaphysical.
Hmm. Amazing. All right, there you go, John. Thank you so much. I think we'll wrap it up, all right?
You bet.
Amazing stuff. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your time. And let's keep in touch, certainly, and do it again sometime in the future.
Let's do it again. And the closer we get to 2012, it should be an exciting time to bring a lot of folks together, maybe do a round robin on your show one evening. Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, you know, John Jenkins is a friend of mine. He's been on the show a few times, and I know he is familiar and appreciative of your work and likes what you're doing. And Jay Widener's a buddy of mine, and, you know, Dennis and
get Jay on there, and Jeff Stray and John Jenkins, and
holy cow,
throw Harper in there for a referee or something.
We'll jam the web for hours.
Oh man, so. We'll make the popcorn. We'll do it.
All right, John, we'll do it up, and I'll be in touch with you. Okay.
Thank you, Nell. It was great.
Thanks so much.
Get on your show.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Everybody, John J. Harper, wonderful stuff on the web. www.johnjharper.com. He's written an amazing book. It's called Transformers: Shamans of the 21st Century. Great stuff, and I'm so glad that John and I got together.